with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, May 21st, 2026. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Cedar, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, packed show, folks. We've got Dr. Yossin Haga back with us to reflect on the U.S.-China summit from last week. And later in the show, Milot Quiros, candidate for Colorado's 1st Congressional District, joins us again. And as an extra special treat, my friend Matt Bernstein of A Bit Fruity will be with us to talk about our interview with Mallory McMorrow. Just a little bit of it, reflecting on that. Also on the program, Iran is reviewing the U.S. ceasefire proposal, but Axios says Trump and Netanyahu had a very tense call. Where have we heard that before? Welcome back, Joe Biden. Meanwhile, Israel is escalating bombing in both Gaza and Lebanon, including killing over a dozen in Lebanon earlier this week. After a federal judge issued an injunction, the White House backs down, dropping sanctions against UN Special Rapporteur on Palestine, Francesca Albanese. Democrats say they have the votes on the War Powers Resolution, and they're done with the rotating villain strategy. Golden says so, but we'll see. Senate Republicans, the ones who won't be back in power anymore, turn on Trump. Courageously on the ballroom funding and the weaponization slush fund. So that DNC autopsy was finally released, and in nearly 200 pages, the words Israel, Palestine, and Gaza were not mentioned once.
Competent party.
Yep. What a coincidence, after a tobacco company donated $5 million to a Trump super PAC, the White House rolled back vape regulations 1 week later. Actually, less than 1 week later. Minnesota becomes the first state in the country to ban prediction markets. Good job, Tim Walz and Democratic Party there. Shocker, Trump's cuts to foreign aid are making the growing Ebola outbreak worse, experts say. RFK Jr. fires the experts tasked with determining what preventative care insurers must cover under the ACA. The retired Tennessee cop who was jailed for over a month over a Charlie Kirk meme has agreed to an $800,000 settlement. Honestly, it should be more. I don't know. Over a month! Brad Lander leads Dan Golden by over 30 points in a new Emerson poll, the incumbent. And lastly, James Murdoch, the Kendall Roy type, buys half of Vox Media and New York Magazine. That's good news for freedom of the press. You know, the son of Rupert Murdoch. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome to the show, everybody. We have one I am saying no sound, but I am assuming
that's a joke from yesterday, I think.
Oh, that's a hilarious joke.
Yeah.
It's so funny.
You had to be here for it.
I had to be here for no sound. I gotta say,
Don't do that in the future.
It's a little less funny to me to scare me about technical difficulties in the middle of headlines, but I'm not going to yell at the audience today because I love you all. And I take Thursdays to suck up to you just as a part of my strategy with the slow rolling coup that we are laying the groundwork for here at the Majority Report. Hello, Matt. Hello, Brian. Hello, beautiful audience that I never get upset at. We have a lot to get to today. I want to make sure that we had my dear friend Matt Bernstein on to reflect on the McMorrow interview that we did. People should go check it out if they haven't already. But we already had some great guests, so we're making sure that we make this show as packed as possible. I don't know. I'm emphasizing that. I should probably just get into the news so that we don't waste any more time. So
good radio, though, to say you got a packed show.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm just stay tuned, folks. So the negotiations with Iran continue. Iran says they're reviewing the U.S. proposal. The U.S. has effectively kind of held off on resuming bombing Iran because Iran has so effectively themselves used their geographic leverage over the Strait of Hormuz and have been very successful at making the West feel economic pain for this and the rest of the world in many ways. Trump uses his social media to threaten bombing and violence, but no one believes the paper tiger anymore. The markets don't believe the paper, the cheetah. Get it, Cheeto? Anyway.
Okay. Packed show, everybody.
Okay. Iran, though, does say that like over 30 ships have passed through the Strait of Hormuz as of this morning, and this comes on the heel of the U.S.-China summit as well. It appears that Iran is charging tolls, which is objectively a strategic defeat for the United States. And Trump, because the Israel lobby is more focused on this part, is fixated on the nuclear weapon piece. Now, Iran can concede things as it relates to uranium enrichment, I think, because they have so effectively used the Strait of Hormuz to defend themselves and the economic leverage that they have over the rest of the world. But Israel is constantly moving the goalposts about uranium enrichment, and much of the lobbying effort that defeated the JCPOA, and Trump gladly undid it because Obama was the one that negotiated it, was about lying about Iran's level of uranium enrichment. And that continues to this very day as a way to keep the United States embroiled in this criminal war in Iran. So there's apparently a schism here. The new Ayatollah doesn't want to send the uranium abroad to be warehoused elsewhere. Perhaps some of the more moderate factions in Iran have a different opinion, but Trump is upset about it. He doesn't like dealing with the new Ayatollah because it reminds him that, like, you can say it was regime change as many times as you want, but it's the exact same regime, just not the old guy that was in charge of it before. But the bad news, too, is that Israel's continuing to bomb Lebanon and Gaza amid these negotiations. The genocide in Gaza is ongoing. That means, in my view, at least from watching from the outside, that the U.S. and Israel have gotten Iran to effectively kind of soften their demands as it relates to this so-called axis of resistance, with Hezbollah included and Hamas as a part of it as well. Israel's trying to escalate their bombing campaigns in both Gaza and Lebanon as a way to undercut these negotiations. And as I mentioned in headlines, Axios, like we're in Biden's term once again, says Trump and Netanyahu had a very tense call and the Israelis were really upset. Oh my gosh, who's falling for Barak Ravid's Kabuki theater anymore? I'm not sure. Because at the very least here, Trump kind of just says what's on his mind about how he feels about Netanyahu in particular and how he feels about Israel. It seems like Israel has captured his heart.
What have you said to Prime Minister Netanyahu about Iran and how long to hold off on strikes?
He's fine. He'll do whatever I want him to do. He's a very, very good man. He'll do whatever I want him to do. And he's a great guy. To me, he's a great guy. Don't forget, he was a wartime prime minister. And he's not treated right in Israel, in my opinion. I'm right now at 99% in Israel, I could run for prime minister. So maybe after I do this, I'll go to Israel, run for prime minister. At a poll this morning, I'm 99%, so that's good. But no, he's a wartime prime minister, and I just don't think they treat him well. I think they have a president over there that treats him very poorly.
You're on the same page with him on Iran?
Yeah.
You know, if we had a competent opposition party, that ad would be played all over the airwaves, given the level of toxicity and hatred that people feel in this country for the state of Israel dragging us into a war with Iran that is materially impacting every single person with these crazy, crazy gas prices. I saw that there was an analysis released yesterday, from the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy showing that over just this holiday weekend that's upcoming, Memorial Day weekend, Americans will collectively spend $3.5 billion extra on gas because of this war in Iran. So, like, yeah, you can. There are many people that don't care about children getting bombed and a massive genocide with a drastically undercounted death toll in Gaza and Israel's expansionist aims. But damn do they care if they're paying that much more for gas at the pump and it's impacting their lives. So you have Trump going out there saying how much he loves Netanyahu, which everyone associates Israel with this war now. And there's no amount of capture from Zionists, of media organizations and social media companies, that is going to change that fact. I sometimes hesitate to emphasize this because I don't necessarily think that this changes things electorally, and I don't want to overstate it. But I can't ignore some of these numbers that are coming out with Republicans on this, because it's bad for them, and I want to incentivize a fracture in the Republican base. And the more that the Democrats could do this, potentially by emphasizing Israel's influence over Trump, again, I won't hold my breath with leadership, but perhaps there's some competent Democrats that will do this, the better it is for defeating fascism. Scroll just to the bullet point portion here. This is on young Republicans in this New York Times Siena poll. This is perfect. Thank you. On almost every foreign policy question asked in the poll, the 18 to 44-year-old segment of the Republican coalition takes a dissenting view. This is the difference between older Republicans and younger ones, and it's really stark. A majority disapprove of Mr. Trump's handling of the war in Iran, and only 40% say he made the right decision in choosing to attack Iran. Only 33% support providing additional economic and military support to Israel, compared with 72% of those 45 and older. I just want to linger on that for a second. 33% of Republicans under the age of 44 support additional support, military and economic support to Israel, compared with 72% of those older than 45. That is more than double the level of support. It's a massive for all of the talk in our mainstream press about how it's Jewish people that are buoying support for Israel in this country and how anti-Zionism would be an electoral liability in more Jewish areas of the country. Are you kidding me here?
More evangelical areas. Maybe.
It's evangelicals and old Republicans that are maintaining support for this genocidal settler colonial project.
We covered it yesterday, but the only age group Ed Gelrein won was over 65.
And you, did you see his part, his election party that had 12 people at it? I mean, let's
it was past his voters' bedtime.
Let's pretend, right? Let's pretend that we're living in a democracy, please. Yeah. I mean, it's crazy, and with that race, not to go too far afield, but the three most expensive primary races in the country have all been successful attempts by the Zionist lobby to take out anti-Zionist or voices that were critical of Israel. They in those three primaries, they were unfortunately successful. So how can we call it a democracy when you can have the Israel lobby take out Massey, Bowman, and Bush in the three most expensive primaries in the history of this country, and we act like the voters really matter here? A majority, 54%, say Mr. Trump has been too supportive of Israel, compared with 16% of those 45 and older. So a majority of Republicans under 44 44 and under say Trump's been too supportive of Israel, compared with 16% for older. Nearly three quarters say America should pay less attention to problems overseas, compared with 40% of Republicans 45 and over. And this part is key. The opposition isn't mostly about young Republicans wanting the party to be less conservative more generally. While younger Republican supporters are less likely to identify as conservative, only 28% said the Republican Party is too far to the right, compared with 16% of those 45 and older. So there you go. The young Republicans, you know, the teenagers that are 38 years old talking about how much they love Hitler in the group chat, are the ones that are motivating the critique of Israel here. This is not some, this is, so I want to be clear. This is an opportunity to break apart the Republican coalition, but this is not an opportunity to grab those voters. You know, we played that triple Trumper guy who said that he was scammed and after voting Trump for a third time. The real question is, like, who are you going to vote for next time? Is it going to be Marco Rubio or is it going to be AOC? Is it going to be J.D. Vance? Is it going to be, you know, Chris Van Hollen or whatever? Like, they'll still probably vote in that direction. And it is very terrifying, this rise of anti-Semitism amongst the young right and the fact that that's motivating it. But as an opportunity to hurt Trump and his coalition, we should not turn our nose up at it, is my real assessment.
I would make another observation about the what this is going to create among in the minds of young conservatives who don't like that their candidate gets wiped out by Israel money. It is going to create anti-Semitism in those people. Those people are fertile ground for it. In fact, that type of Christianity is where anti-Semitism came from.
Yep.
And I'll make two observations that I know are true and one that I think is true. The first is that Israel knows that that's happening. And the second is that Israel doesn't care that that's happening in those minds of those people. And the third is because they're doing it intentionally. Because anti-Semitism is a justification for the ethno-state of Israel. Bibi Netanyahu, Ben-Gavir, they do not care. They do not care one iota if Jews in America are more under threat. In fact, I take that back. They do care. They want it. They want it.
They want that. They, in the way that Zionists critique, I guess, victims of the Holocaust, the real extreme Zionists in Israel say that they were the weak Jews. Yep. If you're a Jewish American that wants to live side by side with other people of other faiths and religions, and you're not moving to Israel to fight the good fight of destroying the Palestinian people, of committing genocide, of, you know, taking up arms to slaughter Arabs, then how could you be the strong Jew that is worthy of survival? And I just want to play a little bit before we go to our break, just to emphasize that while this is, you should take that data as an opportunity to fracture their coalition, there are whole swaths of voters that are gettable that aren't, you know, Nazis or aren't taking you down a path of trying to pursue their votes when once Trump is cycled out and they can get a new, fresher, far-right figurehead, they're going to be more drawn towards this person. These are the voters we got to get. Listen to these numbers from Harry Enten, our wonderful theatrical friend, about non-voters in 2024 and where they're at with the president.
Are changing, that are moving, that are different than the last election.
You know, you mentioned the Republican base in your intro, and then obviously there's the Democratic opposition. But what about those who didn't cast a ballot at all in 2024? Those who didn't show up to vote? Well, they have become absolutely perturbed. I dare say they are pissed off at the president of the United States. Voters who didn't cast a ballot in 2024. Trump's net approval rating. Back in November of 2024, just after the election, look at his net approval rating. It was plus 4 points for his plans in office. But look at that. It is falling. Yeah. Whoo. There you go, Sarah Seidner. That's the only sound you can make. It has fallen through the floor. Look at this. Minus 50 points on Trump's net approval rating among voters who did not, in fact, cast a ballot in 2024. That is, you don't have to be a mathematical genius, an over 50-point move against the president of the United States among those who are kind of like, meh. You know, in terms of voting in 2024, but now they are pissed off.
Well, okay. Well, they're pissed, right? But the question is, will they go out to vote? And so, you know, there were around 90 million Americans that did, that was were eligible to vote that did not vote in the election. Turnout, it was less than 2020, but it is in terms of like past elections, turnout has increased over the years, voter participation. However, there were many, many voters that sat out because of Gaza, because of the economy, because they didn't like both choices. They do not have ideological Nazi views that are driving them away from Trump and fracturing the Republican Party. They are not going to be swayed. Those voters that I just mentioned from on the Republican side, those are not the group of voters that we should be targeting. In the same way that the establishment Democrats are obsessed with targeting the moderate Republican, the online media ecosystem that wants to talk about how Marjorie Taylor Greene is the new GOP or whatever is also overemphasizing the gettability of the anti-Israel right. The voters that Enten just described, that's the pool of people that need to be targeted, and that requires mass mobilization, that requires door knocking, that requires a movement, not micro-targeting that enriches consultants.
Real quick, there's a
New
York Times Siena poll just came out. In order to win the next presidential election, a Democrat party needs to move left, right, center, whatever.
This is the same poll, by the way.
This is of potential Democrat supporters. In other words, people I don't really care to listen to on crime, immigration, or trans issues. But the key number there is that they all think the party, even the people that think they're too far to the left on trans, economic, or immigration issues, they all want them to go further to the left on healthcare issues. And the problem with the Democratic Party is, which party won health exec donor funding in the last election? Well, it was the Democrats. So that's the reason that the opposition party isn't really responding to this, but it's the reason why the left is having an insurgent success in places like Pennsylvania, for instance.
Yep, well said. In a moment, we're going to be talking to Dr. Yostein Haga about the U.S.-China summit. But first, a word from one of our sponsors. Picture this. It is late at night and you're scrolling through your feeds. I wouldn't know anything about that. When all of a sudden you see it, that one product that you have been looking for, you click on the link, you add it to your cart. Maybe you shop around a little bit before you finally hit checkout. And as you're filling in your address, you realize you don't have your cart anywhere near you. You are horizontal in bed with your laptop. You don't want to get up, but you see it glistening. The purple pay button that has all of your information saved, making checking out as simple as a simple tap of your screen. Ka-ching! Shopify is the commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world and 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. from household names to brands just getting started. I am a Shopify user as a customer, but the Majority Report is also a Shopify user as a business. It has made it extremely easy for this show, which is not business savvy by any stretch of the imagination, to have a online store where you can buy our merch. Without Shopify, it wouldn't be possible because you can get started with Shopify with your own design studio. You have hundreds of ready-to-use templates that Shopify helps you build, and it helps you build a beautiful online store that matches your brand's style. It accelerates your efficiency, whether you're uploading new products or trying to improve existing ones. You can get the word out like you have a marketing team behind you. You can easily create email and social media campaigns wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling. Best yet, Shopify is your commerce expert with world-class expertise in everything from managing inventory to international shipping to processing returns and beyond. And if you get stuck, Shopify is always around to share advice with their award-winning 24/7 customer support. Tackle all those important tasks in one place, from inventory to payments to analytics and more. No need to save on multiple websites or try to find out what platform is hosting the tool that you need. Everything is all in one place, making your life easier and your business operations smoother. See less carts go abandoned and more sales go ka-ching with Shopify and their Shop Pay button. Sign up for your $1 per month trial today at shopify.com/majority. Go to shopify.com/majority. That's shopify.com/majority. Ka-ching. It's down below in the video and episode descriptions and at majority.fm. Quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Dr. Yostein Haga.
Majority.
We are back, and we are joined once again by Dr. Yossin Haga, political economist, assistant professor in development studies at Cambridge University, and publisher of the Global Currents newsletter. Yossin, welcome back to the show.
Always good to be on the show, Emma. Thanks for inviting me.
Always great to see you, and always great to talk to you about U.S.-China relations and China in particular. Let's just start from as broad a view as possible. What are your reflections on the U.S.-China summit from last week and what U.S.-China relations are looking like going forward?
So I've always thought that U.S.-China relations are relatively or better than many people seem to think, better than maybe sort of the idea we get from the press. There's obviously a rivalry between the U.S. and China economically, to some degree politically as well. But I've sort of maintained a positive spirit in terms of where the relationship is heading, because there's so much economic dependence between the two nations. And I think that's something that this summit confirmed, that it's heading in a positive direction. You know, one word that Xi used a lot was sort of strategic stability going forwards. And I should mention that I do think one of the reasons why we might see a more cooperative tone also from the United States is because now China is in a more powerful position than, for example, it was last time Trump visited China. So China technologically is now, you know, at the global frontier. They are also a huge geopolitical force and is important strategically, for example, with respect to Iran. So Trump doesn't actually have sort of cards to be as hawkish or as bullying as maybe he would otherwise have been. So the main takeaway for me is that we're going towards maybe something like a cold peace, where they're looking to kind of strengthen cooperation where they can, but still maintain certain trade restrictions toward one another.
How do you, I guess, assess that position from Trump in particular? I mean, it was notable that really quite shortly after the summit began, there were ships that were allowed to pass through the Strait of Hormuz that were going to China, and Trump seemed kind of giddy to be able to provide them with that concession. But in terms of like the Trump's position towards China, is it purely because he has a respect for strength and nations that can throw their weight around economically? Because he has many China hawks in his administration. His Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, notably, is one of them. And yet it feels like they are sidelined right now in a way that is shockingly encouraging, at least in terms of like the silver linings that we can get from this administration.
Yeah, this is an interesting observation. Some people say that Trump is the least China hawkish person in his administration. And maybe this summit actually confirmed that to some degree, because, I don't know if that says more about Trump or if that says more about the Republican Party, that he's the least China hawkish person, because I don't think it's China friendly, but I do think the Republican Party generally has historically had a very hawkish stance towards China, especially many people in this administration have had that reputation. But you are also saying something interesting about Trump's fondness for strongmen, maybe. We also know that he has this good relationship with Putin, etc. But I do think there is something to be said about Trump trying to be strategic with his relationship with China. We've seen that previous U.S. trade policy has backfired against China. And I have an interesting story in this respect about how, you know, U.S. hawkishness and aggressive trade policy has actually boosted China's position vis-a-vis the U.S. So I was in China recently, and I talked to one of the largest companies in the manufacturing sector there, who told me that they've become more innovative or have been forced to become more innovative because of certain export restrictions and also entity list restrictions on this specific company. It's a very big company in China. I just don't want to mention the name, but people who know China can probably figure out which company I'm talking about. Another interesting example in this respect is the critical minerals restriction that China has put on rare earths. I talked to someone in the government apparatus in China who said that, you know, they actually weren't looking for very explicit weapons to use against the U.S. until the hawkishness and the aggressiveness started from the U.S. side in 2018. So I also do think Trump and smart people around him are trying to be strategic here and realizing that having this extremely aggressive and hawkish posture towards China is actually not to the benefit of the U.S.
Can you take us to 2018 and when that hawkishness began? And if you could kind of maybe describe the evolution of U.S. hawkishness towards China and bringing us to, you know, 8 years later in 2026?
Yeah, so, you know, it was during Trump's first administration, and he, as we know, started this rhetoric about tariffs and also reviving U.S. manufacturing, U.S. jobs, and his administration around that. So the first aspect we saw of hawkishness, which was, you know, to some degree also motivated by the fact that China became gradually more and more a powerful stage on the world stage in the world economy and a direct economic competitor to the U.S. So it was not necessarily about Trump or specifically the Republican Party, but also China becoming a growing force economically, more of a direct threat, and also a growing, I guess, military force as well. So it started with tariffs under Trump, the Trump administration, on a range of goods. Then it continued under the Biden administration, and export restrictions under Biden became very severe with chips, for example. Biden also put heavy tariffs on imported clean energy products in an attempt to revive and strengthen clean energy domestic manufacturing in the United States. And then we move on to the second Trump administration. And as we know, things got, you know, extremely crazy under the so-called Liberation Day tariffs, which were just a set of tariffs on a range of goods on countries across the world, including China, of course, and export restrictions continuing that are still in place today, especially on advanced chips to China in an attempt to sort of curtail and prevent China from developing an advanced semiconductor manufacturing industry, because as we know, semiconductors are perhaps the key geopolitical technology of this time.
Well, then that's a perfect way, I think, for us to segue to the story. And I mean, it's, you've touched on it, but the China banning NVIDIA gaming chips during this visit with Jensen Huang, who is Taiwanese-American and, you know, of course, leads the biggest company in the world right now, NVIDIA. And it was a bit of a shock that Trump brought Huang with him to China. I think that, he had his little cadre of oligarchs to join him, Elon Musk, Tim Cook, or as he refers to him, Tim Apple. But you also have the CEOs of GE, of Goldman Sachs, and more. But with Huang coming, and then this ban coming from China, I guess, what do you make of that?
I still haven't seen anything specifically in terms of business deals and economic deals emerging from this summit. There's been relatively little. I thought some huge deals were going to emerge. As you said, we saw him bring this entourage of power CEOs. And actually, we've never seen a U.S. president bring this kind of force of business power in terms of, you know, top Fortune 500 CEOs with him on another state visit. So that's a bit puzzling to see, you know, all these big names joining Trump on the visit and then not something explicitly explicit economically coming out of this summit. So maybe we'll see something in weeks ahead. I'm not entirely sure. But when it comes to semiconductors, specifically in chips, what we know at this point is that the restrictions from the U.S. side remain largely in place. There's been talks of maybe China loosening some of the export restrictions on rare earths. But I also we also know that, you know, Jensen Huang, he is sort of a more bullish person on China, and among, I guess, tech CEOs in the U.S. has a more friendly and cooperative approach toward China.
Is that because of Taiwan and NVIDIA's reliance?
Who knows? I'm not entirely sure. I don't think China, you know, China wanted to talk about Taiwan a lot during this summit, saying, you know, please do not change your approach to Taiwan in terms of sort of recognizing Taiwan as a more sovereign entity, et cetera. It is very dangerous to, you know, China was very clear. It's dangerous to escalate situation in Taiwan in terms of independence in Taiwan. But I do not see, even from the Chinese side, that they actually see a benefit to, for example, invading Taiwan, although they do want reunification with Taiwan. Trump seems a bit more nonchalant towards, you know, with respect to this issue. I think also NVIDIA and Jensen Huang, he's also said explicitly that these export restrictions on AI chips to China, they're actually not preventing China from innovating. Actually, yes. You know, we're seeing a surge in China to innovate in the semiconductor industry right now. And of course, from a business point of view, NVIDIA wants to be able to sell its chips to as many countries, as many people as possible. So if these export restrictions on chips were lifted, that would obviously be good from a sales point of view for NVIDIA.
I mean, Trump being ambivalent about whether or not China takes Taiwan is actually another consistency with him. When you say, like, his fondness for strongmen, it's the same thing with Ukraine. It's the same thing with Gaza. His fondness for Netanyahu. We played the clip earlier of how much Trump saying how much he loves him. Same thing with Putin. And, you know, I mean, Modi, you could throw in there as well. But just his ambivalence about whether or not the strongmen that he favors or looks up to, I mean, particularly if they're in power for a long time, because that seems to be what he wants. He do whatever you want. I'll operate in my backyard. I'll do this, you know, brutal blockade of Cuba, and you do what you want. But you mentioned that you were in China for a few weeks recently, and I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about some of your observations about what you saw there as well, because we've talked about this carbon brief study many times. I think last time you were on, we discussed it as well, how China is growing at its most rapid pace yet, and yet they are declining their carbon emissions. And a lot of this is because they have rapidly invested in their infrastructure. I mean, what did you see when you were there?
Yeah, we all know that there are, you know, a bunch of us in the West are now quote unquote China maxing and are becoming very impressed with the state of the economy in China. And yeah. I have to be honest with respect to some aspects of the Chinese economy. It is extremely impressive. So, you know, the state of infrastructure in China, especially the rail system, for example, is you know, I would say, with respect to both scale and quality, so if you take both of those into consideration, it might be the world's number one. And to see a quote-unquote developing country having the world's best developed rail system, you know, more than 50, I think around 50,000 kilometers of high-speed rail at the moment, which is roughly two-thirds of the world's total, more than the rest of the world combined, is simply insane. I know it's a big country, but they've done it in such a short amount of time. And, you know, I went to big train stations, small train stations. It is honestly super impressive. And you also mentioned, you know, this thing about emissions. So for almost 2 years now, China's emissions have been either flat or falling. This is the first time this has happened in a period when energy demand has been growing, because China is still growing as an economy. And you obviously, you know, this has been due to a huge surge in investing in clean energy technology. You see this obviously very visibly when you're on the streets with just a huge number of either electric vehicles or electric scooters. When you drive around in the countryside, these massive solar panel farms, etc. So you know, China is, you know, one impression that I left with as I left China is that this country is certainly at the global technological frontier. It's not a country without problems. It's not a country without labor precarity. It's not a country without people who are struggling, but it can produce literally anything and at all levels of the value chain. So it really has, you know, it is really at the frontier of most things when it comes to manufacturing and production.
And in terms of how China is operating in the international sphere, I think that we can bring it back to Iran and speak about that in contrast, the United States as a declining global hegemon and China as an emerging global superpower, how China is consistent in dealing in a more cooperative manner and also in investing in things like soft power and infrastructure in developing parts of the continent of Africa, for example. The United States is slashing our investment in developing countries via USAID, resulting in untold numbers of deaths because of lack of care, for example, and then killing people directly in our dealings with the rest of the world, bombing a little girl's school in Iran, committing genocide in Gaza, and then you're seeing Iran go even further into China's sphere of influence because why wouldn't you?
Yeah, I'm really happy you're bringing this up because we're seeing, especially, you know, in the last year now, a clear difference in how China operates on the world stage and how the United States operates on the world stage. How many times can we mention that the U.S. has broken the U.N. Charter and broken international law? I've kind of lost count just in the past year. Yeah. China. I wish more people knew about China that they have a very cooperative approach to international affairs, cooperative meaning that they're willing to sit down, to cooperate, to strike deals with more or less anyone. This is sometimes confusing for countries in the West who think that China is part of some kind of axis of evil with, for example, Russia and Iran. And then they see China criticizing Iran and cooperating with Gulf states. And they're like, hang on, what's happening here? The simple answer is that China has an approach to international relations that's more non-aligned. That is, they don't see themselves as part of this axis, for example, like NATO.
Can I just interrupt for just a second, just to underscore how retrograde Biden's foreign policy is? I mean, defending Ukraine was in the United States' interest, and I'm supportive of that. But the way that he used that as an opportunity to reify the post-World War II order and NATO and tried to build that back up, this over-focus on alliances versus broad-based cooperation is an aging, archaic, idiotic strategy that does not look to the future. And you compare that to China, and I think, you know, we have a very clear picture.
I 100% agree with you here. And, you know, it's become even clearer. I was always on the fence about NATO. And then, you know, now recently I see Mark Rutte explicitly, so the head of NATO, explicitly saying that NATO should be a vehicle for U.S. imperialism. I think he said that a few months ago. And I'm like, what? No. We cannot have this any longer. I also think, you know, you mentioned something important with respect to how China deals with developing countries. And I don't think that's black and white. And there are instances where, you know, China arguably uses some coercive tactics because of its power in terms of bilateral relations with other developing countries. But China actually invests in clean energy and infrastructure in these countries. China does not engage in regime change operations. China does not invade other countries. China does not bomb other countries. China does not impose structural adjustment programs on other countries. It's not a fully benevolent force. But yes, I would say they have an approach to international relations that I think makes me hopeful in terms of moving towards a world of multilateralism and real cooperation rather than these traditional North-South relations that resemble very clearly old sort of colonial and imperialist patterns.
Yes, and just to, you know, so people in our audience don't think I'm perhaps being a little bit too critical of Biden. I mean, I don't think I am, because you could see that Obama's approach was more, you know, of course, maintaining U.S. empire, but he wasn't obsessed with the idea of like reifying these kind of old military alliances. We had the Iran deal. We had a cooling of tensions with Cuba. I'm not trying to overstate it, but like, I'm just, Biden sucks and is not very smart. That's really all I have to say about how his foreign policy was dealt with. Lastly, you know, so where do you see China and the United States moving forward? I mean, I know that we don't have details about some of these deals. I know Boeing really wanted a big deal because they're competing with Airbus, and that was a big market that they wanted to tap into. But there was nothing triumphant that came out of this, a feather in Trump's cap. He wanted to be able to say trillions and billions and all that. I'm not seeing that. What's your assessment of that?
I'm not seeing that either. And I think, again, you know, this term constructive strategic stability that Xi used many times during the summit, I think is a term that is fitting for where things are headed. You know, there's still going to be tensions between the two countries, not only because of the economic rivalry, but also to some degree because of the political rivalry and the geopolitical rivalry. But as China, and I do believe, although it's not an economy and a country without problems, technologically, there's really no sign that China is stopping its surge. And as it becomes more, even more powerful on the world stage, the U.S. is kind of destined to sort of fall into what China wants and how China wants to do international relations. So it will, you know, I think it'll be, I'm quite certain where China is headed. I'm less certain where the United States is headed. Yes, it might be an empire in decline because, you know, they're not exactly making more friends on the world stage. But can it sort of save itself a bit? You know, now with the recent summit in China, you saw actually that they might want to cave in on some of China's demand. If these two powers can actually have strategic, if these two powers can have peaceful and stable relations with each other, I think that is a good thing for the world. And I do think both leaders of both countries actually see that, although we haven't seen, unfortunately, much of that with respect to Trump's actions elsewhere in the world.
Well said, Dr. Yossi Haga, political economist, assistant professor in development studies at Cambridge University and publisher of the Global Currents newsletter. We'll put a link to Global Currents down below wherever people are listening to or watching this. I always appreciate your time. Yossi, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Always good to be with you.
Agreed. All right. With that, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we will be joined by Melat Quiros, candidate in Colorado's 1st Congressional District. We are back, and we are joined once again, a second candidate interview in an election cycle. I mean, it must be pretty special. I mean, I'm a big fan of Melat Quiros's campaign in Colorado's 1st Congressional District. Melat, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, I'm glad to be talking to you because we haven't spoken in a few months. And since that time, your campaign has received, you know, a lot more attention and a significant boost even from, you know, the local infrastructure in Colorado, the district assembly. There was a vote at the end of March where Diana DeGette, the nearly 30-year long incumbent, was barely able to get over the 30% threshold, which is required for ballot access on June 30th. You got nearly two-thirds of the vote in the district assembly. If you could just explain what that is and why that was such a big deal.
Yeah, absolutely. So Colorado has two paths to get onto the ballot. You can either collect signatures or you can go through the Democratic convention. And we went through both. So we were actually the only Democrats in the entire state to collect signatures just with volunteers. Everybody had to pay for organizers to collect those signatures, but we already had so many volunteers that were ready to collect them. So we could have gone on the ballot that way. But we also decided to go through the convention process, which we call caucus and assembly here. And it's, you know, it's a process that I deeply appreciate because it's just a bunch of Democrats in the room that really want to make an active difference in the party and change the trajectory of where we're going because we need to win again and we need to start fighting for working people. That being said, it's not the most democratic process, right? It takes at least 16 to 18 hours over the course of several days, over the course of several weeks. If you have childcare needs, if you work an hourly wage, it's really difficult to be able to meaningfully participate in that process. So we wanted to make sure that we reached every single kind of voter through the signature process and also going through the convention process. And the convention was, it was absolutely incredible. We felt confident going in. Just because there were so many people that were aligned with our values, but we actually didn't decide to go through caucus until I think like 9 days before the deadline. People had been organizing for weeks in advance before that, but we made a really last minute decision to participate. And so we were just hoping to make past 30% originally. And then we started calling folks, asking if we could count on their support. And it started looking like we might get closer to 50%. And then we walked in day of at South High School, which is actually the Congresswoman's alma mater. So the audience was filled with a lot of her former classmates, people she has known for a really long time. You know, the audience, or really just the groups of folks that participate, skew, you know, more older, more, they've really been participating in the party for a really long time. I mean, it's a process that's designed to protect incumbents. And we went on stage, we made our case. I called out who the real problem is, the billionaires and the corporations. I said what we need, which is Medicare for all and, you know, using our taxpayer dollars for healthcare instead of bombs. And I thanked the Congresswoman for her service and said that it was time for a change. That got a lot of really, it was an incredible reception. And then following me, the Congresswoman came on stage and accused me of lying about something. I don't know what. I said she takes corporate PAC money. That's a fact. And that wasn't received well either. And so what I think we walked in with like 50% support, we ended up taking away 63% of the vote. And she was 30 votes away from not making the ballot in that first round. And ultimately in the final round, they send some more delegates up to do the last vote. We actually ended up getting 67% of the votes. We managed to flip a few of her delegates. So she just barely made it on with 6 votes. And she didn't collect signatures also. So that was going to be the end all be all for her.
That's amazing. And you did both, as you mentioned, right? Mm-hmm. And so you have that as a backstop. It also, like, when you collect signatures like that, you're also informing people about your candidacy too. It's mm-hmm. a way to door knock and not also door knock. And then that volunteer army can go and door knock as well. You know, Chris Rabb, huge victory in Philadelphia, and just earlier this week, I saw that you guys have been kind of posting together on social media, and both have DSA behind you specifically. Can you speak about DSA's role in organizing your campaign and how it's made it easier for you to spread your message across Denver?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. DSA is actually the reason why we went through the convention process. You know, it's just a really arduous process. You have to call every single delegate. And we had gotten the endorsement about 10 days before the caucus and assembly process. And I mean, the might of organizing that comes behind DSA is just unmatched. And, you know, a lot of that comes from the fact that these are working people that are actively fighting for the betterment of every other working person in the country. And so they've been doing this work, whether we're talking about, you know, labor rights, whether we're talking about renters' rights. And so we just pulled in all of those organizers to help us get through the convention process. And just like you said, while we were also collecting signatures, we were also informing voters about us. And those volunteers are now in the process of helping us get out the vote. And we are really, really lucky to say that we have over 500 volunteers supporting our campaign. 200 to 300 of them are actually on the ground here in Denver that are canvassing for us at least twice a week, phone banking and text banking 2 to 3 times a week. And that is truly the power of DSA, right? We call it the DSA difference. I am so honored to have the support of this organization and to be fighting alongside people like Chris that are so fearless in this movement, right? We're at a crossroads where there are things that are going to happen in the next few years that are going to set the trajectory of this country for the next few decades. And if we are not at the helm as democratic socialists that are laser focused on ensuring that we're protecting people's most basic needs, I'm really scared about what's going to happen. And so to see the win in PA with RepRap is, I'm just so, so proud of them.
What do you make of this, I mean, the state of Democratic primaries right now, and what are you hearing from voters that indicate how badly people really want to change?
Well, I think the first major indication for me was actually during the convention process when there were people who had gone to class to high school with DeGette, who had voted for her proudly for the last 30 years, and heard my speech and said, look, I'm grateful for her service, but you're right. There has to be a change, and it has to start with addressing the corruption that's in our own party. Because the thing is, we cannot call out the corruption of Donald Trump, of the Republican Party, without cleaning up house on our side of the aisle. And when you have Democrats that are taking millions of dollars from Big Pharma, Big Energy and Oil, defense contractors, AIPAC, voters lose trust that we are going to be the ones that are actually fighting for them just because we say we are, right? If we're still taking that dirty money on the side, then how can they actually trust our intentions? And so I think it's really shown that Democratic voters are ready for a change. And I also think it's shown that Republican voters are not, right? We also saw in the same night that Massey and that race, what, that was another record of 30-something million dollars spent. And I think it makes it clear that Republicans are not ready to have this conversation about the special interests and the impact that it's having on our government. But Democrats are. Rep. Rob won despite being challenged by two establishment Democrats, despite being outspent by a lot of these special interests, because we are actually talking about the issues that matter most to the voters.
And, you know, we're getting some really great IMs about your candidacy, but you mentioned AIPAC, and of course, Israel is so central right now in these campaigns because it is a litmus test for how people can trust you. Do you support the slaughter of children or do you not? You mentioned you support Medicare for all, universal child care, but you also support an arms embargo to Israel. Why is that important for you to say, versus just say, oh, I'm going to end, or I would vote against offensive weapons sales? As a reminder to people, your candidacy got started after you were fired from the law firm that you worked at because you criticized their response to protests against the genocide.
Yeah, the campaign was a couple of years after I got fired, but that cemented a lot of things for me, right? No, you're good. You're good. That cemented a lot of things for me, understanding the dynamics of our jobs and the things that provide us our livelihood, preventing us from speaking out on these atrocities that end up becoming genocide, right? And for me, it's important to say we need an arms embargo because words matter and so do policies. You know, the reality is the genocide in Palestine has only gone as far as it has because it is funded by our taxpayer dollars. That is just a fact. And if we want to end the genocide, if you are a candidate that's saying we need to end the violence and we need to protect the children, then stop sending the weapons that are killing them in the first place. It's really that simple. And I think more than anything, the frustrating piece about it is that this is the popular position. This is what Democratic voters want. It's the party that is not caught up on this issue. And it's going to take more and more of us that are running in positions against these incumbents, against the establishment, to say that you are the ones that are out of step with the voters. And the voters want to see an arms embargo so we can finally start working towards peace in that region.
And the arms embargo, to clarify, would also include, say, funding for the Iron Dome, which, you know, I think sometimes when it's spoken about as defensive weaponry, it's not necessarily painting the entire picture, which is that the infrastructure could still be in place and Israel could still pay for it, but we wouldn't have the diplomatic cover from the United States that also allows them to steal land belligerently because they know that they can't receive any because of the United States defense missile defense system, really any significant damage that would harm them in that pursuit.
Exactly. I mean, look, we saw reporting from the Times that the administration and Israel they were waiting for the Biden administration to tell them to knock it off. They were waiting to be told that they needed to commit to a ceasefire, and it never came. Our taxpayer dollars, our funding of this weaponry, is our leverage. That is how we can stop the violence that is happening there. And I want to be clear as well, exactly what you said. A weapon is a weapon, right? There is no distinction between offensive and defensive, because at the end of the day, it is the weaponry that gives them the impunity to commit this genocide in Palestine in the first place. And I want to make it clear that this isn't just about not giving them free weapons. This is about halting every sale of every weapon, period, until we have a true ceasefire and an actual delivery of aid and a commitment to rebuilding Gaza and a commitment to a right of return, a commitment to actually seeing peace, dignity, and security for every single person in that land right now.
Love that answer. Really appreciate it. I just want to read some of these IMs because we're getting a lot about people even in Colorado who have been canvassing for you. Cameron from Denver. I've been canvassing from a lot in Denver, and I've had so many positive encounters. It's been really inspiring talking to neighbors about issues that matter to them and seeing it connect that there's a candidate who actually cares about those issues. It seems like people are ready for a change. Also, obligatory Denver DSA plug. Join your local DSA chapter. Folks, Science is Political, saying that now that they've graduated, they have the time to phone bank for you in Denver. And this one is great, too, from the same person. Science is Political. I know an older military veteran over 75 who is friends with Diana and even has said that she's been MIA as a congresswoman. He said he likes Melot's fight. So that's got to be a pretty great endorsement, huh?
No, we'll take it. Honestly, you know, it's funny. We talk about this being a generational fight, and in so many ways it really is. But some of my strongest supporters are voters over the age of 65 that are knocking on doors for us, hosting house parties for us. Because for a lot of them, either they're ready to pass the torch, they want to see the next generation of leadership actually, you know, being in public service and fighting for the kind of solutions that maybe weren't available before. But some of our older voters, they've been protesting since Vietnam. They've known these problems for a really long time. And I think we're coming to a point now where this money in politics issue is no longer just a slogan. It's no longer this abstract idea. People really can concretely see just how corrupted our government and our politics and our campaigns have become. And I think that's what's gotten us so many fired up, excited volunteers. I always brag, we've got the best volunteers in the state. They are doing so, so much work. And if there are any other folks that are in Colorado that are listening to this, please join us. We're canvassing every single weekend. We've got socials afterwards as well, too. It's a really incredible community we've been building.
How can people do so? It's a great way to plug your website. If they want to volunteer or phone bank for you, where should they go?
Please, yes. Go to kurosforcode.com to just learn about the race and learn about our priorities and everything. And then go to win.kurosforcode.com. That's going to be where you can find everything for canvassing, for phone banking. We've got a bunch of events that are also happening. In fact, if you're in Colorado, we are having a town hall tonight, which we're really excited about. But there's so many ways to get plugged in. And then if you also go to our socials at @KurosCo, you can find everything that's happening on the campaign that way, too.
A lot rooting for you over here on the East Coast. We'll put a link to all of that down below wherever people are listening to or watching this. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a wonderful. Bye.
Thanks. Bye. Thanks so much. All right, folks, quick break. And we will be joined by Matt Bernstein in just a second. We are back and we are joined by my dear friend Matt Bernstein, host of the A Bit Fruity podcast. If I talk about how wonderful Matt is, I might like actually get a little bit choked up because I love him so much. One of my great friends, Matt, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Emma. And I do know this to be true because it doesn't take that much to get you choked up. So,
yeah. Okay. Well, that's obvious. I've definitely cried just talking to you about you before, because I mean this with all sincerity. You are extremely talented and brilliant and very kind and wonderful. And so the fact that we get to collaborate together is such a joy in my professional life.
Oh my God. I couldn't agree more. And I'm so excited to talk about what we have done.
What have we done? What have we done, Matt? We've made some waves.
We did. Do you want to team me up or?
Yeah, that was me teeing you up, my dear love.
Well, so for those who haven't followed this sort of saga, obviously there's this very contentious Michigan Senate primary between Haley Stevens, who's like the AIPAC candidate, Mallory McMorrow, who's like the centrist candidate, and Abdullah Sayed, who is the progressive pro-Palestine Medicare for All candidate. And I've done an interview with Abdul and on my podcast, A Bit Fruity. And after we published it, Mallory McMorrow, the centrist candidate's team, reached out and was like, we would love to do an interview as well. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was pretty stunning considering like the way we sort of like maligned some of her, views. And obviously like I was interviewing his opponent, but she wanted to, and she was like, Mallory, you know, has this amazing LGBT record and we're fans of the show. And I was like, I the first thing I did was text Emma because I was like, gee, like,
they're fans, you know, of the show.
I mean, I said yes, and then they requested a topic list, and I wanted to make calculations throughout the whole process that would tee me up to get the interview. And so, you know, a lot of people said, well, you should have never submitted a topic list. But, you know, then she could have just as easily been like, well, we're not going to do it then. Mm-hmm. So there was kind of a game.
Well,
I think
we decided when we were chatting, if we want to take a little bit of a peek behind the curtain, we had been talking about potentially me joining this interview for a little while, even before she ended up canceling. And your response was, when they asked about what the topics were going to be, you responded to the McMorrow campaign and said healthcare and foreign policy, which is absolutely as vague as possible. But it was both what we wanted to ask her. And that answer that she'd had about Medicare for All has been a bee in Sam's bonnet for a few months at this point. And so I was like, perfect opportunity. Then they canceled the interview. You have a large social media following. You called out the fact that they canceled the interview after those were the topics that were relayed to them. And then they came back and said, okay, actually, we'll do it. And that is why we ended up getting that interview, and we did it on Friday. We recorded it last Friday. It came out earlier this week, and it's been making the rounds. Let's just play a little section of it, because this part, I think, was maybe one of the funnier moments.
Partisan U.S. support. And so I wonder, if you continue to support defensive weapons infrastructure to Israel, how you see yourself as utilizing any of the leverage you could have as a U.S. senator in this situation. And I guess because like this two-state solution line, right? It's the party line for a long, 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 long time.
Since the 90s.
And it just hasn't borne out. I think probably everyone on all sides of this issue could agree with that. And so I wonder how you are breaking from the establishment in a way that would materially benefit the people who, frankly, like my tax dollars are killing.
Yeah. And I'm glad that you framed it that way, because I think there's a difference, Matt, in how you asked your question versus Emma. One is the specific framework of the borders of the nations. The other is what leverage.
Okay, that's really it. First of all, good job in the editing, keeping both of our little smirks in as we looked at each other on camera.
Oh, I had to. I love a little drama.
I know you do. And so, well, that was funny. That was kind of the tone. I'm not sure if she was consciously trying to split us up, or if it was more just organic in the moment, or if she'd been familiar with the majority report's criticisms of her before. But I guess, what do you reflect on with that interview, like how it went, why it seemed like she was really trying to appeal to you but be hostile towards me throughout? And I mean, how do you feel about it? I we haven't really talked about it that much.
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts about it. I mean, I actually added in some of my like solo thoughts at the end of the actual video in case people want to watch it, just about her answers to my questions. But I think, you know, I actually don't think, despite the fact that I think we did a pretty good job with the interview of pressing her on like, why do you support the Iron Dome? That was really what I wanted to ask her. I was like, why do you support a two-state solution when that has never borne out in reality? And why do you support the Iron Dome? Because you say you want peace, but how is that leveraging your status as a senator to create that reality? And the thing about me that I think is like not cut out to do these sorts of things is that like I'm a very, very like soft person. I always have been. And the thing about Mallory McMorrow is like I when the interview came out on Monday, I was like, I bet I'm going to be the reason she has a really bad day, you know?
Right.
And I am not great at politics because I sometimes struggle to like divorce those like very personal feelings from like, this is policymaking, you know? And like, I'm sure that it would be fun for me to get a drink with Mallory McMorrow. Like, I bet she probably like gets down at a good drag bar or something. And with that being said, like, I think that we should hang out. I think that we should have fun. And I think that she shouldn't run for office on these positions.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. I don't, first of all, you did phenomenally, and it's a callus that you can build where I've felt the same way as I've like been doing more of these political interviews, but you start to kind of just get the focus on, you focus on what the goal is and what do you want to extract, and you want to ask specific policy questions. And I think we achieved that, and you did a great job of that. But like, what do you make of her saying that she was a fan of you, I guess, and you know, what do you think they thought your politics were?
Well, a lot of people have commented, because she said in the run-up to the interview that we're such fans of the show, she said in the interview itself, I've been a fan of you for years. And then a lot of comments were like, how has she been a fan if she clearly like didn't see these questions coming? Or how is she a fan and supports the Iron Dome? You know, it doesn't make sense. But I've been on the internet for a long time, and I've kind of grown up on the internet, and I've sort of grown into my political identity while I've been really public. And so like, you know, like my earliest like viral content on Instagram, if people don't know, and I'm glad that they don't, because it's, you know, the road is long, but it was just kind of all about like LGBT type, very like Hillary Clinton era love is love stuff. I was like a 19-year-old gay boy who was like coming out into the world and being like, this is like the thing about me that I want to talk about all the time. And for a long time it was. And so then, especially when that became the center of these culture wars, really starting with the Ron DeSantis Don't Say Gay bill, and I think 2022, and LGBT politics did become like the focal point of American culture wars for a while there, I was sort of well positioned to be making content about how ridiculous it all was. So this is all to say, I do believe she was a fan of me at that time. And I do believe what she said of like, oh, we were circulating your Instagram content in the Michigan State Senate. I believe that. And maybe she just hasn't looked at like really anything that I've done since then, is all I can speculate, you know?
Yeah. And there was, at the end of your kind of recap of the interview, you mentioned how there were a few things that were contradictory that she kept doing. Mm-hmm. One was saying that we shouldn't be making determinations based on polling about how our policies should be oriented. And that was as it related to Israel. And when I was pointing out how an overwhelming amount of the Democratic base wants to cut off all arms, there was a new New York Times Siena poll that just came out that also reified those assessments from other polls. I mean, it's a 90-10 issue with Democratic voters. So she was saying that essentially we shouldn't be making policy determinations based on that. I think I followed up with her saying morality is also a part of it too. So the polls are, the voters are on your side, and it's immoral to continue to support Israel's genocide. But then earlier in the interview, she had been talking about how she can't support Medicare for All because the polling isn't there, or the numbers and the support for that isn't there. And as you pointed out in your recap, what are we supposed to be making policy assessments based on in terms of what you're running on if it's neither polling nor ideology?
Yeah, that's right. She, you know, she said multiple times throughout the interview of like, well, sometimes the job of a senator is to put their personal, to check their beliefs at the door, and, you know, represent the majority of people who are their constituents. And then we were like, okay, well, this is what the majority of your constituents believe. And she was like, not like that though. And it's like, well, okay, so if it's not polling and it's not beliefs of your own, then it's like this third, like amorphous, like we're never gonna know. I mean, it reminds me of like the opaqueness right now around like the DNC autopsy. It's all just like, this is what people hate about Democrats right now, is that like there is no transparency around what your decision making is. None.
Right.
And you know, she also kept saying that you know, I'm someone who's breaking from the establishment in a pragmatic way, which like we can get into like what that even means. But I kept coming back to like, how are you breaking from the establishment? How?
Yes. And she kept trying to say she was, but with having zero policy positions that would justify that claim. It's been interesting because, you know, as you mentioned, you're kind of just more dipping your toe into some of the political interviews, politician interviews. But you had the Abdullah Syed interview, which was great, and that was why McMorrow wanted to also kind of get FaceTime with you on your platform. Have you been getting other interests from other politicians, and what can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, since I started doing this stuff, it was really since I live in New York City and campaigned pretty hard for Zoran and with his team and following them to the events and stuff, because I was, you know, that was like the first time in my life where I was like, I'm really excited about a politician. And so it was really since my involvement with that campaign that a lot of politicians have started to reach out, despite the fact that, like, if people don't know me, like, most of my stuff is really like focused on like the political aspects of culture. Like, I just put out a 2-hour long podcast episode about like clavicular and like, you know, generational nihilism. And like, that's kind of my bread and butter. But I think the politician stuff is fun. I think it's sort of fun toying with them a little bit, as we did here. I don't think it's particularly hard to do as long as, you know, you can get them in the room with you. I think that's the hardest part. And speaking of, you know, one campaign that that was initially reaching out through surrogates to me to try to, you know, do a collab or like do content or something was that of Scott Wiener. In San Francisco, which is actually where I am right now.
Running against Shoykat Chakrabarty.
Running against Shoykat Chakrabarty, exactly. And Scott Wiener has a long history of, you know, aiding these sort of pressure campaigns to get people fired. Like, I think the president of a university fired for, like, even speaking with the, like, SJP chapter, like, something like that, like Students for Justice for Palestine.
For saying that he, you know, for entering into an agreement with them about divestment, he led a campaign to get this university president fired.
Yeah. I mean, Scott Wiener has been sort of like an staunch Zionist for the entirety of his career until like 15 minutes ago when he decided to run in this district. And he, as soon as he announced his campaign, he was like, I've resisted the word genocide for 2 years. But, you know, now I'm calling it a genocide. And it has nothing to do with the fact that I just launched a campaign in a district where if I don't call it a genocide, there's no way I'll ever get elected. So, and you know, he's still running on these sort of like liberal Zionist policy positions. There's no world in which I would support him, frankly. But you know, he is also really running on like gay identity politics. There are posters for him all around the city. His logo has a rainbow.
He's tall.
He's running on being tall. He's 6'7", which, like, now I know that because that's like a policy that he's running on. But he has, you know, he has a rainbow flag in his campaign logo. And anyway, he, you know, one of his campaign surrogates wanted to like make content with me. And then the evening, on the day that we put out our McMorrow interview, I was notified that his schedule has been booked, and it's filled and
forever.
And well, not forever. He said, maybe we can talk after the general. I'm sorry. After the primary.
The primary. After the primary when, of course, there's no risk. So exactly. There you go.
So, you know, and it's just, I think, you know, one of the risks for me in doing this McMorrow interview is I feel like I had really one chance to like do a good job with it, because now there's probably going to be a period of time where none of these people will talk to me because they know that I'll answer or that I'll ask very simple questions about like, why do you support funding of any kind to a state that's committing a genocide? And that's not a gotcha question. It's just a question that for a number of reasons, these people can't answer. And so, you know, now they won't let me ask it, but I'm glad I got the opportunity to do it once with you, no less.
Yes, exactly. And I really appreciate you bringing me in for that. I mean, Sam's best advice that he's ever given to me is about if you're going on a show, like a right-wing show, you go and you behave like you're not going to get invited back. Because if you're worried about getting invited back, then you're not going to do a good job. And that's some advice that I've really internalized. And I think you can kind of extrapolate that to interviews with candidates. Like, why would we have held back? This is much more impactful than, say, a bunch of kind of more lukewarm interviews for politicians that are coming down the line. You just have to take your shots when you can get them.
That's right.
So everybody needs to check out A Bit Fruity if you aren't already. I have been on a few times. What we did a Deborah Messing episode about her liberal Zionism, or not liberal Zionism, her Zionism.
That was sort of like a magnum opus for me also. Deborah Messing is like this random fixture in my brain, probably till the end of time. And we explored her descent into like being a pro Netanyahu lady, you know, after having received like GLAAD Media Awards in the mid 2010s. And Emma helped me dive into what the hell happened there.
Yes. But you just recently had Naomi Klein on. So if people aren't already listening to A Bit Fruity, please check it out. Folks, we got some nice IMs and then I'll let you go, Matt. But Floyd the Barber, I don't know if Matt was the first, but he did a great job of being kind and fair with Ashley St. Clair while also holding her accountable. Neither he nor Juniper let her off the hook, but they gave her space at the same time. Spaghetti Brain says, Matt, you are so good at interviews. You're already great at podcasting, so would have been okay if interviews weren't your strong suit, but you are so good. Wuhan Emma, thanks for sharing on the tough emotions and complicated human relationships about speaking truth to power. Dave from Talon says, does Matt realize how much more devastating it is to hear, I think you're fun, I'd like to hang out with you, and I don't think you should run for office, then I think you're evil and you shouldn't run? I mean, that is kind of devastating, I gotta say.
Can I just say, like, that thought has like kept looping in my head since our interview, where I'm like, you know, I don't know the ins and outs of what's happening in the Michigan State Senate, but it sounds like she's done good stuff. Like Mallory, you know, gave that viral speech where she like really stood up for LGBT people amidst like the height of the culture wars in Michigan. I'm like, maybe stay in Michigan and keep doing that stuff. You know, I don't think everyone has to climb the ladder of like insatiable power to the point where then they get, you know, bought out by these donors and whatever, and put forth indefensible policy positions that I have to imagine if Mallory McMorrow were just an individual that I was getting dinner with, that she could not defend.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And like, that's the part of me that's like, I want to see the best in everyone. That's, I feel like, what I always do on my podcast. But I'm just like, just don't run for federal office. Just do something else. You seem like a fine person. Just do something else.
I would agree. Well, Matt Bernstein, we will put a link to A Bit Fruity and, of course, the full interview below. Great to see you, my friend. And yes, it's always fun to collaborate.
Love you so much, Emma. Thank you for
having me. I love you too. Okay. All right. Don't make me cry. Okay. Bye. With that, we are going to wrap up the first hour of this show, the free part of the show, and head into the not so free part of the show where we will take your calls and read your IMs. Matt did just dip out, because I got him sick and he's still not feeling great. So Brian, what's happening on Left Reckoning and
I don't know yet.
I'm Jacobin show.
Sorry, I'm still looking it up.
Okay, soon enough.
I don't know right now. Hold on. You can. How about Just Coffee?
JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee and some other thing. I forget if it's tea or if it's chocolate. I should probably know this by now. As a reminder, this show relies on your support. You can go to jointhemajorityreport.com, become a member. It keeps us resilient when we're on these third-party platforms that could take us off at any moment. Okay, Left Reckoning.
Yes, yesterday a new episode came out. Matt and David discuss AOC's take on the American Revolution before Romp Cone joins Matt to discuss AI cluelessness, Zoran, and politics in California.
Very nice. All right. And I think we will be joined by Brandon Sutton in just a second. We'll read some IMs as we bring him in. Vox Populi, Emma, why didn't Matt B stay for the fun half? Well, because it can get a little crowded when we have a bunch of people in the fun half. But one day we got to do that. I'm going to definitely be collaborating more with Matt. Ostentatious Hassan watched your interviews live the minute it was available on YouTube. He was visibly so proud, the two of you. I did see some clips from that, so thank you so much for Hassan to Hassan for watching. Spaghetti Brains, that McMorrow was interview was embarrassing for her when Emma asked how she thought the land should be split up. She completely backed away from the issue, and that was Chef's kiss. Yeah, she couldn't answer the two-state solution thing. It just drives me insane. There are 700,000 plus illegal Israeli settlers in the land that's supposed to be Palestine. You're going to forcibly remove them? That's your policy? And then I sarcastically made a joke about a Palestinian Iron Dome, and she was like, that's an idea. Oh, so like, just instead of cutting weapons to one country, let's give weapons to every country.
Right. Nothing safer than a standoff.
Nothing safer than that. And you know what's going to just get 100 out of 100 votes in the United States Senate? A weapons defense system for Hamas.
No, I mean, no, it's brilliant. We will arm both sides of the war. That's how you make double the money.
Ka-ching. Hello, Brandon. Hello, Matt Binder. Brandon, what's happening on the discourse?
Well, we are very excited at the discourse, which you can watch over on YouTube or Twitch if you search for the discourse with Brandon, because of the news that Michael Bay has been attached as the director to the dramatic recreation of the pilot rescue. From about 7-8 weeks ago. You've probably forgotten about the dramatic rescue of pilot Jesus Christ on Easter in April.
Wait, are you joking or is this real?
This is real. He's been attached as a director with the same writer who wrote the Benghazi movie that had John Krasinski in it.
Yes.
Because, you know, John Krasinski is a big Benghazi guy.
NCIA
13
guy.
Hours or something.
So is that guy's whole shtick now is doing pro CIA?
Jack Ryan.
Pro yeah, yeah. US so military.
So he's a super big Benghazi guy is what I've heard, which in this case means that he's big into like the Hillary Clinton did Benghazi, liberals love Benghazi kind of thing. I don't want to mischaracterize him, but I have heard that like when the Benghazi movie that he was in did poorly, he took it very personally and he kind of like really just dove headfirst into doing like stuff like this. And that's why he's in that Jack Ryan show, not to be confused with the Jack Reacher show, where he talks about nuclear Venezuela and like, I don't know, suicide dolphins or whatever. But yeah, so Michael Bay and the guy who wrote the movie, the Benghazi movie that John Krasinski was in, are attached to be like the team helming the, I guess, movie adaptation of the rescue of the pilot in Iran that happened 7 weeks ago. And so we're excited over on the discourse, which you can watch on YouTube and Twitch, for more information about this guy to come out, because it seems like now that they're making a movie, they'll have to tell us some more about this guy. So we're hoping to, over the next few days, be able to at least like start to unpack what could have possibly happened on Christ's birthday or resurrection day or whatever, you know, bris, last month. So yeah, definitely check it out if you're interested in that kind of stuff, or like ghosts and goblins. We got really into like the Antarctic ice wall this week too. Definitely check out the discourse.
Do that. Hello, Matt Binder. What's happening in your neck of the woods? You are muted.
Pilots once again.
Whoops.
I'm back. Okay.
We
sorry
hear
about
you.
That.
All good.
All right. Yeah. YouTube.com/MattBinder tonight, 8:30 p.m. Eastern time. Leftist Mafia, tune in. I kept it short as possible because I ruined it by muting myself.
You didn't ruin anything. Don't worry. We've had much worse technical issues that we've just completely plowed through. So, all right, guys, we will see you in the fun half.
Okay, Emma, please.
Well, I feel that my voice is sorely lacking on the Majority Report.
Wait, whoa. Look, Sam is unpopular.
I do deserve a vacation at Disney World. So, ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to welcome Emma to the show.
It is Thursday.
I think you need to talk over for Sam.
Yes, please.
No. I'm gonna pause you right there.
Wait, what?
You can't encourage Emma to live like this. And I'll tell you why. So it's offered a tour, sushi, and poker with the boys. Sushi and poker with the boys.
What?
Tour? Sushi and poker.
Tim's upset.
Tour? Sushi
what you did to Tim Pool was mean.
Free speech.
That's not what we're about here. Look at how sad he's become now. You shouldn't even talk about him. I think you're responsible.
I probably am in a certain way, but let's get to the meltdown here.
Sushi and poker with the boys.
Oh my god.
Twerk?
Wow.
Sushi.
I'm sorry, I'm losing my fucking mind.
Someone's offered to twerk?
Yeah.
Sushi and poker with the boys.
Logic.
Twerk? Sushi and poker with the boys. Boy.
Twerk?
I think I'm like a little kid.
I think I'm like a little kid.
I think I'm like a kid.
Twerk?
I think I'm like a little kid.
I think I'm like a little kid.
Add this debate 7,000 times.
A little kid.
I think I'm like a little kid.
Little kid.
I think I'm like a kid.
Twerk?
I'm losing my fucking mind.
Some people just don't understand.
So I'm not trying to be a dick right now, but like, I absolutely think the U.S. should be providing me with a wife and kids.
That's not what we're talking about here.
Okay, all right. It's not a fun job.
Twerk?
That's a real thing.
That's a real thing.
Boss.
Willy Wonka.
Twerk?
That's a real thing.
That's a real thing.
What's that?
Offered to
twerk?
That's a real thing.
That's a real thing.
Boss.
That's
twerk.
A real thing.
That's a real thing.
Boss.
That
offered to
twerk?
Ladies and gentlemen, Joe Rogan has done it again.
That offered to
twerk?
That's a real thing.
That's poker with the boys.
I think he might be blowing it out of proportion.
Real thing.
That's poker with the boys.
That
offered to
twerk?
That's a real thing.
That's poker.
Let's go, Joe.
Twerk?
Sushi and poker with the boys.
Take it easy, Dan.
Twerk?
Sushi and poker.
Things have really gotten out of hand.
Sushi and poker with the boys.
Delusional.
Twerk?
Deluded.
Sushi?
You don't have a clue as to what's going on.
Live YouTube.
Sam has
Twitch.
The weight of the world on his shoulders.
Poggers.
Sam doesn't want to do this show anymore.
Can't do it anymore.
It was so much easier when the Majority Report was just you. You were happy.
Let's change the subject.
Right.
Rangers and Knicks are doing great.
Now shut up. Don't want people saying reckless things on your program.
That's
now,
one of the most difficult parts about this show.
This is a pro-killing podcast.
I'm thinking maybe it's time we bury the hatchet.
Left is best.
Trump.
Violet.
Twerk.
Don't be foolish and don't fucking tweet at me and don't bitch. It's the way Emma has cucked all of these people. Love it.
That's where my heart is, so yeah. I wrote my honors thesis about it.
Oh.
Sorry.
She wrote an honors thesis. I should hand the main mic to you now.
You are to the right of me on foreign policy.
We already fund Israel, dude. Are you against that?
That's a tougher question. I have an answer to.
Incredible theme song.
Hi, Bumbler.
Emma Viglin, absolutely one of my favorite people. Actually, not just in the game, like, period.
We are back, folks. It is the fun half. Somebody writes in, can y'all please talk about how insane Rogan and Andreessen were? We will get to one of those clips in just a bit. G-Tier's Smoke Alarm says, McMorrow deserved more clowning on that Palestinian Iron Dome comment. She got a lot of clowning on that one, I think. Matt of Minnesota, as long as this keeps Bay from touching Transformers for longer. Majority Report Peace Prize. Weapons for all is music to defense contractors' ears everywhere. June Oliver, we love Matt Bernstein. Yes. Cottonmouth, the MR Mattiverse is expanding at an alarming rate. Yes, there's too many Matts in my phone.
Apologies.
Yes, change your name, please. Eli from Jersey, favorite Emma quote is still from her honeymoon. Love you guys. You don't have to say it back. Yes, yeah. Well, I know who's gonna say it back and who isn't. Matt Bernstein and I have a friendship that we are very emotive with one another. It's not that much of the case in this office with a bunch of straight men, I just gotta say. Like, how I act with Matt Bernstein is how I act with all my other friends that are not straight men, for the most part. Lots of loving and affection that I don't typically get to show on the show, which I'm now, I mean... And plus, you guys are men, too. I'm around... My cats are both men as well. I'm married to a man. I'm around so many men. Straight men.
You call your cats men?
They are men now. They were boys, now they're men.
Many men.
Silicon Valley leftist. The McMorrow interview felt like Matt's equivalent of the I've Had It podcast interview with Booker. Centrists see the culture and identity politics, think it'll be a slam dunk profile piece, and then they get blindsided by real investigative journalism. Hope he continues to do those sorts of interviews. Totally agree. MPG, Matt, I'm a very soft person. Emma, I know within 5 minutes of meeting a person how I will destroy them. yeah, I mean, at least with politicians, it is something that you can build to a little bit, I think. But it's hard at the beginning to be that adversarial. Let's do this here, Six. So this was a really interesting clip to me. You know, America First, it's always been a bit of a scam, this brand from the Republican Party. It actually comes out in relation to World War II, because there was this America First committee that was opposed to fighting Nazi Germany. It was isolationist. It was more, you know, nativist. And the Trump administration harkened back to that with the Madison Square Garden rally. They really often blamed Jewish people directly for our foreign policy. I mean, I think Tucker Carlson and the right-wing ecosystem that is critical of Israel is tapping into that history as well. The America First thing was also like anti-communist, and then communist.
Also World War One too.
And World War One.
Not wanting, yeah, during Woodrow Wilson.
Right.
Not want to join.
They were Woodrow Wilson, another one there. But you know, like it also always had elements of anti-communism in it, and Jews were often conflated with communists, and that is like a very kind of American flavor of anti-Semitism. And I just say this because America First is about to come up in this Newsmax interview, where I was surprised to see this line of questioning about Cuba on Newsmax. Here's Rob Finnerty with Representative James Comer asking about Trump's policy towards Cuba.
This Cuba thing, Secretary of State Marco Rubio released a message to the people of Cuba today in Spanish. Then Raul Castro gets indicted. I get it. The Ayatollah is gone. Nicolas Maduro is in jail. But now Cuba, I think people struggle with how this is America First when gas is $4.55 a gallon right now.
It is, and you're absolutely right. But at the end of the day, Cuba has always been a national security threat. And as you said earlier, we've been negotiating with Cuba since before I was born. I'm 53 years old. So the negotiations have gone nowhere. Cuba's leader is at the end of his lifespan. The Cuban people clearly, unlike maybe the Iranian people, the Cuban people clearly want a regime change in Cuba. It's just, you know, minutes away from Miami and Florida in the United States. So it's a strategic problem for the United States.
But do you really think they're a threat, Mr. Chairman? Do you really think that Cuba's a threat?
Well, if some country went in and loaded Cuba with the same drones that Iran had when we first started bombing Iran, then yes, I think it could be a threat. I don't think that's there. I know John Ratcliffe has been on the ground. The CIA's on the ground as we speak. Talking to the Cuban officials. I really don't think, Rob, it'll get to any type of military action, but the president's threatening that. He's increased sanctions on Cuba. I don't know how many more sanctions the Cubans can take, especially after what happened in Venezuela. The Cuban-American population clearly supports what the president's doing in Cuba. Thus far, it hasn't cost any tax dollars.
Oh, Cuban-Americans,
send a few diplomats to Cuba. But at the end of the day, I think that we've got to be on guard because of the new types of warfare that's out there with these new drones and this new technology.
I get it.
We're seeing
Cuba,
it play out in Iran.
I understand that. Axios had a report this week that the U.S. is concerned, I'm sure you saw this, about a possible Cuba drone strike on Florida. Mm-hmm. And I'll be honest, Mr. Chairman, I know that you've got the security clearance to know more about this, but to me this just sounds like we're trying to make the case to attack Cuba. I don't buy it. It sounds like a false flag operation. Would you support military action in Cuba if it came to that? And I guess more importantly, do you buy this report in Axios?
Well, I know that I've been one of the biggest critics of our intelligence community over the past 10 years. They're usually wrong. They usually do everything they can to get us to the point of warfare because that's what they like to do, apparently. But at the end of the day, I don't think anybody right now supports an invasion of Cuba or anything else. We're hoping that this can turn diplomatically. Again, with the age of Castro and with the economic conditions the worst they've ever been in Cuba, I think now's a prime time for a strong president to go in and try to change that country and hopefully get it done. He's, you know, made some great progress in other countries.
All right. So that is honestly an incredible moment where that's Finnerty, right? One of there are a few Robs that work at Newsmax that look exactly alike. Schmidt's the other one, but Finnerty, there, I'm not exactly sure if I remember that correctly, but that was really interesting because, I mean, Comer just spent multiple minutes making the case that he essentially calls a false flag for how they could, Cuba, in theory, buy these drones like Iran has.
Yeah.
Can we just talk about how embarrassing it is that they're acting like these cheap-ass drones that are so infinitesimally cheaper than all of our expensive military equipment that our taxpayer dollars are funded towards to create our weapon systems, that these cheap drones have been able to easily patrol the Strait of Hormuz and inflict damage in ways that are easily replicable and not subjected to all this extraction from U.S. defense contractors that make the materials that our government buys from them as expensive as possible. So, yeah, he's essentially saying that do you buy that they're going to that there is an attack that's imminent, because it doesn't make sense for him to say, hey, maybe Cuba's going to buy these drones and attack us. And it sounds like he's soft launching the intelligence community's attempt to manufacture consent for military action in Cuba. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they learned their lesson from the Iran war debacle. You got to do the false flag first. You got to at least like manufacture a little bit of consent. You got to build a little consensus before you go in. But even with that in mind, and with the understanding that there is a big constituency for this in like Southern Florida and the Cuban expat community, which is one of the few communities still behind Trump, it's hard to interpret this indictment for this old man as anything other than Trump lashing out after being embarrassed by Iran and like, you know, real warfare. And so now he's like inflicting as much pain and as much, I guess, symbolic humiliation onto Cuba as he can imagine. But I mean, it's really embarrassing. It's a really embarrassing time to be an American when, because he can't defeat Iran in warfare, he goes and like starts a fight with a 95-year-old man.
Yeah. Or, you know, an island nation that is right off of our coast that is as susceptible to this kind of sadistic blockade, by the way, that is actually killing people and is ongoing and pushing the Cuban healthcare system to the brink of collapse, with hunger on the rise as well. I mean, this is what a rapist in who's the president does, picking on the weak and reifying his masculinity and his military readiness and toughness by picking on somebody who isn't his own size, basically.
And I just can't help but notice that, you know, who else is not indicted, but, you know, is still walking around? Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton, a lot of Epstein associates. Ghislaine Maxwell is going to be free in a few weeks. She's already running that prison, essentially, is what they, you know, are saying on the news, that she basically runs that prison. And so, I mean, you just can't help but notice that the only people getting indicted are like 95-year-old Cuban, you know, retired presidents, and none of the people who, like, people are calling to get indicted.
Right. And the way that he talks about the Cuban people, and that's why I got a little confused, because the Cuban American diaspora does want regime change and does acutely understand how close Cuba is off our coast and how easily it could be used as a way to make a lot of capitalists rich. What he's talking about the actual Cuban people, I mean, it's hilarious to hear James Comer in his drawl just like speak about what the Cuban people actually want, because they're facing such a horrible economic situation. You know, it might be to do with the blockade that I just mentioned that is destroying their ability to provide health care for their own people, where there are babies in NICUs that are at risk of dying because there isn't enough energy there, that we're starving people in Cuba because of a centuries-old humiliation to American capitalists and the group of diaspora in Florida that Trump needs to juice in order to maintain some semblance of popularity as he becomes, definitively one of the most unpopular and worst presidents of all time. I mean, this is the level of narcissism and sadism that's coming out of this White House. So this is also another here Republican on Cuba. This is Senator Kennedy. He knows what's right here. And listen to him talk about Cuba and ask yourself what country this actually sounds like.
And number two, Fidel Castro, the original Castro, was pretty smart. He was evil, but he was smart. But these asshats since then have just been incompetent. They're like three-wheel shopping carts. I mean, they're just incompetent. All they know how to do is oppress people. They take all their money and they give it to the military and the police and themselves. And to hell with the good people of Cuba. And that's not a model for success.
No.
And they're gone. And they just don't know it yet, whether we do it through an invasion or not. I'd rather do it the easy way, but that's kind of up to the communists who are running things.
What's the easy way?
Yeah, could you imagine if a country just cares so little about its people that you have these corrupt leaders that lead it that are aging and out of touch, and instead of investing in the people of their country, they just give all of the money that the government collects away to the police and to the military? How horrible would that be? Oh, the Republicans right now are negotiating over a $1.5 trillion military budget, right?
Mm-hmm. How much did ICE get?
Yeah, so much so that even Senate Republicans aren't like falling over themselves to fund that part of DHS, which is still not funded right now because the slush fund is so large that ICE is like, all right, we can run on this for quite a while right now.
I mean, I don't know. It's $1.5 trillion enough? Like, given all that we already spend, like $950 billion wasn't enough to defeat Iran. Like, are you sure that you don't need like a good $1 trillion? Like, how many zeros do we have to dedicate to this? Because it seems like, I mean, if anything, we're not spending enough based on these.
You're right. We shouldn't, let's not even assess whether or not we should be waging war with Iran. We should be taking a page out of Chuck Schumer's playbook and just talk about it in degrees of scale and in terms of which paperwork should be filed in the correct manner.
Of course.
Now think about the war itself.
What is the easy way and the hard way? Is the easy way is starving them to death.
Yep.
And the hard way is bombing them to death.
And perhaps a ground invasion. And right. Kennedy might, the guy, and no relation, but the Kennedys haven't had a great experience with other folks in the government wanting to do a ground invasion of Cuba and attempting to kind of box a Kennedy into that position. I have much more faith in how JFK responded with much skepticism towards the CIA and the powers that be that were attempting that than this complete fraud, John Kennedy, who really puts on that accent to obscure the fact that he went to, what, Oxford?
Yeah, he's a Rhodes Scholar.
Ah.
He's British?
Yeah.
We've been joking.
Could you imagine?
But honestly,
that would be great.
Like, oh, dear.
His accent is so ridiculous that it sounds like a British actor, like a Benedict Cumberbatch doing a Southern accent. Three-wheeled shopping cart.
Well, I mean, if the only thing keeping Cuba from being free is 94-year-old Raul Castro, surely the easy way is just waiting for him to die of natural causes. You know, like, he is 94 years old. So I think we can agree that if this is all because of that, if it's all just because of like those dastardly Castros, then like, I mean, the time is going to like solve the problem, certainly, and, you know, within the foreseeable future. And so it does feel like, I think, you know, maybe an overreaction to indict the man and I guess like be unable to even extract him.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with you if you were thinking rationally, but at the same time, you says that time can do more damage. Time has not helped us out recently with some of these guys, these leaders. I've been waiting on Father Time to, you know, wield his sword, and not much is happening in a positive direction on that front.
Best doctors in the world are Cuban, too.
Yes. Well, that's the other thing. Like, they provide health care for their for education. Like, Kennedy's describing America,
I know.
But not all the things that Cuba actually provides for its people, let alone the world. Cuba trains its doctors to help other people around the world.
That's their first mistake.
That's right.
It'll be their last, too.
They should have been Cuba first.
Is it just the name brand of Castro? Is that why they keep going? Because he hasn't been president for, what, 6-7 years?
I think it's a way, it's Pavlovian, you know?
They need branding.
We have an IM saying your audio is slightly quiet.
Well, lucky you guys.
Floyd the Barber, Chuck Grassley reaffirms that time moves slower in Iowa. El Knipsion, you guys missed it after the Cuba segment. Will Cain starts asking Senator Kennedy about his TikTok videos featuring the elliptical exercise machine named Margaret after Margaret Thatcher. Who? Okay, I guess we missed that. It wasn't at the top of our list, but who names their elliptical exercise machine anything?
I wasn't listening to what you just said. Who named their... What?
Senator Kennedy, apparently, according to El Knipsion, in this segment, Will Cain asks him about his TikTok videos featuring his elliptical exercise machine named Margaret after Margaret Thatcher. Ugh.
So he really is British. Like, he's actually British.
It's weird to name your car. Yeah, right, right. It's weird to name your car. I think so. Let alone...
My Honda Fit was named Fetisha.
Excuse me?
My Honda Fit, I named her Fetisha.
Okay, well, I know you're doing it tongue-in-cheek. But as somebody who grew up with a grandparent that got vanity plates, I wasn't really into driving in that car. It was a little embarrassing. I don't think you should name your car, let alone your elliptical machine. That's just a hot take. We don't need to anthropomorphize everything. Curse of the Mamdani. I was reminded of the Crystal Ball Slotkin interview when I watched Matt Bernstein's interview. If the ossified politicians want to ply an audience, we end up with weak Dems who fail when they have to go on the big stage in the general election. Without hard interviews, we end up with, I would do nothing different when Harris tries to catch softballs on The View. Exactly right. Oh, El Knipsion. I was being sarcastic. Okay. All right. Well... I'm glad I spent that time on that.
It got us somewhere.
I do remember in there was a My Strange Addiction episode that I watched in high school about a man that had sex with his car and named him Chase.
Oh.
I had a friend named Chase, so we enjoyed that segment, obviously. But Chase, I mean, sexy name for the car that you're banging.
He wasn't just banging his car, but he was addicted to having sex with his
car? Yeah, it might have not been My Strange Addiction, but there is a montage. I remember the car's red, and he kisses it a lot. Yeah, on the video.
I think any amount constitutes addiction. You're not supposed to have any amount. Like, so, you know. I thought when you said My Strange Addiction and you brought up cars, I thought you were going to say the one where the person is like addicted to huffing gasoline, because that was one of my.
I remember that one. Or the woman that was addicted to eating cat hair was also, not great. Her doctor was like, "You're having intestinal issues." Just like, I can't stop.
The heyday of television, the halcyon days. You could put anything on television.
My
Strange Addiction and MTV True Life. You could see some real like crazy stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Intervention. That was a good one.
Yes, I remember Intervention was dark as hell though.
I loved
it. Was that guy who was like such an alcoholic? He was drinking Listerine. Yeah. And it just felt like at a certain point I was like, Listerine has to be more expensive per like volume than cheap vodka. I was like, I feel like Listerine, like they want $10 for a flask of Listerine now in Trump's America. You get like vodka, you get some like Mad Dog 2020 for like $5.
I knew people who would drink mouthwash on Sundays because you couldn't get, because of blue laws in Georgia, you couldn't get booze on Sunday, so they move over to mouthwash.
Oh, blue laws. I thought you meant like you only drink blue things because of Listerine's color. Like Georgia some crazy laws. The American South still doing all of that, like old timey stuff.
It would
stuff.
Be red if it was in the South.
Yes, it would be.
Yeah.
Let's do 8 here. We'll just go in order. 8 and 9. Actually, let's do 9 then 8. So in Texas, The runoff between John Cornyn, the incumbent senator, and Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton is going to be next week. The fact that Cornyn didn't run away with this is a real problem, I think, for the Republicans here. That there was a third candidate in the primary that didn't split the vote. And, it meant that no one hit 50%. So the top two, I believe those are the rules in Texas, are headed to a runoff. And Ken Paxton has like a litany of scandals. He was impeached by the Texas House in 2023 because of some, you know, a corruption scandal. Then the Senate acquitted him. But in those proceedings, it was revealed, you know, that he had an extramarital affair and his wife was a state senator who listened to the proceedings and was a part of it. And then she ended up getting a divorce from him or asking for it on biblical grounds. Like, it was a messy, messy, crazy thing. He was having some affair with a Christian influencer, apparently. I was reading this morning in New York Magazine. So, you know, this isn't great for them because they want to be focusing their energy on Tallarico. This is a really big race. And so Ken Paxton here is trying to prove to voters that he's the best choice to go up against Tallarico, who has had a head start and has been able to focus on the general since he defeated Jasmine Crockett in the primary. So let's see what the Republicans have going for them in attacking this, you know, almost uncomfortably wholesome man.
Six gender Jimmy.
Okay, that was the first idea. All right, Madison had an idea. Come here, Madison. You have to say it the way we talked about, not the whole, yeah.
Low T Tallarico.
Oh.
That's kind of like low energy Jeb, isn't it? Okay, and then how about we got one more? Tofu Tallarico. Okay, I think you won. I think it is that right? You won?
Is that what he said? Whole food?
Six chin.
Tofu Tallarico. Whole food Tallarico. Dang.
Really tackling the issues over there at that campaign event.
What, didn't they accuse him in another one? They were throwing out that he was a vegan and he's just not a vegan.
Yeah, we have it in the Trump clip. Trump calls him a vegan.
Oh, so. Trump calls Tallarico directly a vegan?
Yeah.
Wow. God. So this apparently happened on the same day. What internal data did they get that caused the Republican Party to collectively start to brainstorm nicknames for Tallarico? This is why he was the better candidate, regardless of policy, in my view, to go up against. I mean, like, I still think his platform was better than Crockett's, which was a little bit incomprehensible, and she didn't upload it until very late in her campaign. He focuses on the billionaires, and he has this kind of Boy Scout wholesome Christianity that emphasizes empathy that I think is a powerful antidote to whatever this is. Like, people are sick of the Trump people. Trump is not popular, and I know it's Texas, but the sadism, especially towards our Latino brothers and sisters and our neighbors in a state like Texas, might be a problem for them. And so all with Trump and the Republicans going after this guy Tallarico in such a mean girl way, and him to just be standing there looking like he's 12 years old and talking about Christian love, I just don't think it plays. But let's see what Trump, I'm sure Trump will be more measured and related to the facts.
His candidate, who's Ken Paxton, I think he'll win. I think probably he'll win very substantially, and I think he'll go on to defeat a very defective candidate that believes in six genders, and he takes hits at Jesus Christ, and he's wearing a mask 6 months ago. Wears a guy, anybody wearing a mask 6 months ago doesn't get it. And he's a vegan. He's a vegan in Texas, and you can't get elected as a vegan in Texas.
Did you talk to Senate leadership?
Texas candidate. So there you go.
Gosh. Well,
he believes in six genders. Yeah. Oh, I mean, and apparently honestly, it was Tofu Tallarico is what he was saying.
Oh, Tofu Tallarico. I mean, haven't the soy farmers in America suffered enough under Trump? Now he's denigrating tofu. But that
great
does,
point.
I mean, actually bring up another point. You know, he probably shouldn't remind people that they won't be able to afford meat soon with his policies. Because, yeah, you know, it's Memorial Day, ground beef in some places like $16 a pound. It's $17 for a Big Mac. You know, it's probably not good to bring up meat eating and just at this stage in the post-apocalypse.
That's probably a good point.
Tallarico posted, I don't have it right ready, but he posted a picture of him eating a giant turkey leg in response.
Yeah. Oh, I love meat. Dogs on Main Street says, I think it's because Tallarico gets potato breakfast tacos that everyone was making fun of him for, a normal taco choice in Texas. Also probably why they said tofu Tallarico. I mean, it is, when you get a breakfast burrito to get potatoes in it, I mean, I would get eggs and potatoes in it, but it can taste really good. You can get tater tots in breakfast burrito. Getting a little hungry.
That's some real, like, Dijon mustard on the burger level criticism here. We're back to that level of politics. Oh, this guy doesn't stuff his burrito like a man enough.
Right.
And it's just like, bro, why are you pocket watching? Like, but the pocket is a burrito. Like, he doesn't get the right kind of hot pockets. He doesn't get the pepperoni pizza kind. Like,
yeah.
It's so sad.
Well, Dave from Jamaica says, I don't know, the Trump cult seems strong, well, based on the Kentucky results. I'm not saying that Paxton's not going to come out of this runoff, but I mean, like, it's a different story when we're talking about a general election right now with the level of activation. My big concern, and I still think that this is not getting talked enough about, is that in Texas, this is a really key race, and Trump is going to try to deploy ICE to polling locations. You have a governor in Texas that would be more than willing to suppress votes that are going to go towards the Democrats and be more than willing to allow for that kind of intimidation tactic in a very Latino state. So my big concern is that in the fall, Trump is going to go focus a lot on Texas if that race looks kind of close at all, and ICE intimidation tactics will be as aggressive there as they could be. Rory in Minnesota, 2 years ago, Ken Paxton shared an AI-generated image and story about a baby mammoth being found in Yellowstone. He shared it thinking it was real. Genius. Man Shovel, sounds like Trump's prosthetic palate from chronic cocaine abuse was slipping in that video. I don't think Trump does illegal drugs. He looks down upon, he found his brother weak for being an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. And most of what we know about his drug habit is that he's, you know, it's prescription. Because I think, you know, there is a certain class of really rich person that, you know, sees illegal drug use as a moral failing and is beneath them. And I think Trump is one of those people.
Yeah, because of his brother.
Yeah, because of his brother.
And his vice is, I think, he's girls. His son. Just like Chris D'Elia, Bill Cosby, Ted Nugent, they're all sober. All those people.
Interesting.
I think he just has bad sleep apnea. I think his sleep apnea just has gotten so bad that it's like when he's awake, and they've just got to prop him up with one of those like CPAP machines, but like Darth Vader style now, like just 24/7. And then
yes,
we can get those lungs cleared up. Like, come on.
Yeah.
Apex Shakur, MR Crew, my Trump derangement syndrome is cured. No way I could ever vote for a man who could be affiliated with tofu like Trump. I mean, Tallarico. Tallarico. I meant to say Tallarico. Yeah, Tofu Trump. That's what they're calling him now that he just gave away the farm to Xi Jinping.
Right. He's trying to sell all that soy that China won't buy from us.
Exactly,
anymore.
Exactly. That's what we should be starting. I've been seeing online that there are some, you know, Republican accounts that are saying that there actually was election fraud this time in the Massey race, but Trump's in charge of it now. I don't believe that. I don't believe that the votes were changed, but do I want the Republican base to maybe think that? Yes. Julio, unfortunately, in Alabama, do you remember they tried to link him with OnlyFans models because he followed them on Instagram? Yes, it's like, I mean, that was a humanizing moment for that guy. Leftist Rage, Emma, I remember that My Strange Addiction episode frequently. It left quite a mark. Yep. Sergeant Flex, dang, Emma, way to make a guy feel bad. I named my car after a Pokemon, which my children love fondly, by the way. All right, well, I completely agree that if you name non-living things with human names, that's absolutely weird. I'm not trying to make people feel bad with my hot takes. I saw people were very upset that I didn't like the movie They Live and think it's perhaps the least subtle satire that could possibly ever exist.
I'm a woman. I don't know what you expect.
Essentialism. Woke is dead. They keep saying Piers Morgan was right. Woke is dead.
I have hot takes. I throw them out there. I'm sorry if people take it personally. It's just that I'm right 100% of the time, and so you should probably listen to my taste.
Right wing 100% of the time appears.
Yeah, they live is incredible. I can't let it go.
Okay, all right. I know I'm not always right. People can have their taste. I don't take it personally.
Yes, you do. You
100%. Yep. If I can't convince you of something, then am I lovable? It's just, you know, it's just something to consider. If I can't win the argument, Bob Villain, if ICE is deployed at polling stations, how are we supposed to resist? Well, I don't know, dude. I don't know. It's hard to say. I mean, I think just community solidarity and just essentially like making sure that people understand that it's their legal right to vote. Ryan and Tempe wanted to give a shout out to Phoenix Metro DSA member Bobby Nichols winning a seat in the Tempe, Arizona City Council yesterday. Shout out. Josh in California, Ken Paxton, a belligerent criminal who spends time crowdsourcing mean nicknames. What does Trump see in him? Ha. I got to give credit to Trump that he comes up with most of those on. He did back in the day come up with most of those on his own.
Democrats might be his worst work.
Yet. Yes, that yes.
Was brutal.
Democrats. And I took the B out.
Yeah, I got rid of the B.
Yeah, he's so strong.
He's dropped the ball. He hasn't got yes. it the same. He hasn't got the juice like he used to. He's got a little bit of juice still, but not as mm-mm. much.
Let's do 13 before we have to run. Joe Rogan had Mark Andreessen on the Joe Rogan Experience.
Finally.
I mean, God, again? We've been waiting for him to come back, and it's like, which billionaire oligarch is Joe Rogan going to glaze next? And we were waiting in suspense. I mean, Rogan has really evolved into his final form, which is just cosplaying as an everyman, unconvincingly, to propitiate the working class into signing over their power, their agency, their ability to critically think over to billionaires that want to take away their jobs. Like, literally. I mean, listen to how Andreessen here is talking about what AI means, what the future of AI is, and the glee with which he talks about how he's going to make sure that your job gets replaced. And the Joe Rogan listener seals listening to this are like, what exciting right. technology.
This is also the man who, what did he say about deep thinking? It didn't start until the 1900s or something.
Yeah. It was something about how
like workers
self-criticism or
self-reflection. Yeah,
self-reflection didn't exist prior to the 1800s. It's like, God, right. you have not. I mean, for
he
all
hates
the
humans.
He hates humans, and I mean, it's not another frequent guest on this show is Peter Thiel, who couldn't, when Ross Douthat asked him if he wants the human race to survive, he could barely answer the question. So these people are antisocial freaks that Joe Rogan, you know, uncritically launders to the public.
And you hate They Live. You don't like the movie They Live.
Stop bringing that up. Stop bringing that up. We're going to lose half the audience, especially if it's a Rogan clip. This is going to be all men watching this.
I just bit my tongue.
Okay, but the satire is not subtle at all. It's like punches you in the face almost. Anyway, here is Rogan. Damn. On Mark Andreessen on Rogan.
Probably a lot. Okay. So that's the state of the art. That's the state of the art today. What's the obvious next step? The obvious next step is the bots should have bots.
Oh boy.
Right. Managers, right? You should have managers, right? And so you should have a bot that's overseeing bots. And this is what's starting right now, right? So each bot should be able to itself create subbots, right? And then you have a bot that gives out the assignment to the bots. And so then, and this is just starting right now, but like when we're sitting here in a year, I think it's going to be routine to have 10 to 20 bots each that have 10 to 20 bots. Right. And if you think about it, this exactly mirrors what happens when a company grows, right? Which is, you know, a company grows, you know, you don't just hire 100 people, have them all work for one person. You have managers, right? And then you end up with an organization chart, right? With like a reporting chain, like at any big company. And so that's what's going to happen with the bots is you're going to end up overseeing an org chart of bots. And then, of course, a year after that, it's going to be bots, managing bots, managing bots, right? And so then you're going to have two layers of reporting or three layers of reporting. And then you're going to have individual programmers that are overseeing 1,000 bots at a time, right? Which means you're going to have individual programmers that are 1,000 times more productive than they were before, right? And so now you've given every programmer in the world this level of superpower and capability. And you see what I'm saying? It's true that they're not writing the code themselves, but they're overseeing the entire thing. They're directing the entire thing. They're developing the strategy. It's their product sense that's going into it. It's their business goals that are going into it. It's their creativity that's going into it. They can let their imagination run completely wild. By the way, this also goes back to the thing. The bots never get frustrated with you.
Right.
Right. So you tell a normal person, you hire somebody here and you tell them you want a screen display and you want it to be an animated version of your thing you got back here. Okay. They spend, 2 weeks doing it. They bring it to you. They animate it. It's like, okay, that's pretty good, but I actually want the whole thing to be whatever, purple and green. And they spend a week doing that and they come back and you're like, I actually preferred the old version. The guy gets like pissed at you because he's like, I just wasted my time. The bot's like, no problem. No sweat, like whatever you want. And we can try it 12 more times if you want. And if you want, I can create subbots to go do, 12 more times right now. Right. Or you tell it, this is terrible. Like, I can't believe you came back to me with this. It has all these bugs. And it's like, oh, I'm so sorry. I'll go fix these. Right. And by the way, never gets drunk. Never gets sick. Never gets high.
Right. Never gets depressed because his girlfriend broke up with him.
Never files HR complaints.
Right.
Right. And so, as you see what I'm saying, and so all of this, right. This is the workplace version of what I described earlier. So all of a sudden, everybody in the workplace has this, basically think about it as an army of bots at their command.
Oh, an army of bots at their command. So
I need to goose my bots.
The first part of this clip is him describing essentially... at the very top, there's the bot, and then they have sub-bots, and then more sub-bots beneath them. Like, sort of like this, like the shape of a pyramid. Now,
or
we don't...
his skull.
Well said. Yeah, that's where he gets the vision. Now, pyramid schemes are wrong because they are exploitative of the people at the bottom of the pyramid. So I guess we don't have to worry about the great grandchild bot being exploited. But we heard the second part of that response, which was him bragging that he's having humans train the bot pyramid scheme to replace them because they never bitch. They don't complain if you sexually harass them or you keep them there past the hours that they should be and they miss their child's recital. They never... maybe have a hangover. You don't have to be nice to them. You don't have to interact with them. And they're not mouthy back to you.
Do you have to pay them?
Good question. That might be the number one thing that he didn't really want to reveal. Yeah. But you could tell how excited he was given the inhalation in those dry ass nostrils. My goodness.
I do think that... the idea of bots training other bots, we're already seeing the consequences of that already with like the kind of degradation that some of these who are training on the output of other bots are starting to output themselves. Like AI slop is being trained on AI slop. I think that's just like a thin veneer for the other part of that, the very anti-human, the very anti-worker part, because you're supposed to imagine that this particular system is going to be able to replace your workers, but it's not going to really be able to replace like the quality that human labor is able to replace, because if for no other reason, part of that quality is that, you can hold them accountable. What it is going to allow you to do is like justify replacing all of that like human labor until, you can no longer justify it because, you can, hey, well, like they don't complain. They don't like file a sexual harassment suit against me. They don't like, question whether or not I'm like incompetent at my job. And so you're going to have a lot of companies that are just one CEO and their three different accounts to three different AI models that are probably like going to go under in the next, decade.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like the and when he talks about bots, it's just I can't understand the average Joe Rogan listener listening to this, where it's like I deal with a bot with, say, a customer service representative and how agonizing that is. And he's just like gleefully talking about, I know it's different, but it's like, oh, then the if you're on the phone with somebody on customer service, then the bot's going to send you to another bot and then this other bot. Well, I mean, yeah.
No, I was going to question, do like Joe Rogan's fans even like these episodes? Like I don't watch the show, like, but are these like the popular episodes of the show? Like, do his fans listen, like want to call it? I mean, like not call in, but like tune in to listen to like Mark Andreessen for the fifth time this month talk about this? Like, don't they want to listen to like a jujitsu guy? Like even just Eddie Bravo talk about how the moon is fake and how like a Kimura can be used to break someone's arm in five places. Like, is that not the Joe Rogan experience? Or like Adam Carolla even, this is like, I can't imagine anyone really wanting to hear this. This is like AstroTurf for sure.
I think you're on to something, Brandon. Let's check out the comments here.
Holy moly, I did not anticipate this. They say it's for your safety, it's for the exact opposite. The tread on me experience. Can't wait to hear how the digital techno-feudalist dystopia is actually a good thing for us. I'd like to propose bringing a flock camera and laptop to Joe, giving him some instructions and letting him see how secure and effective it is instead of hearing it from the single person most financially invested in the company and technology. Wow. Train by day, record everyone by night. All day. Let's put a camera in this guy's home and office. The way this guy inhales is driving me crazy. The billionaire apologist experience.
We haven't skipped one.
Damn. There you go. I mean, answering that question.
The blowback against AI is very real. Like anyone who is paying any attention to this, it's like unbelievable how roundly AI is being dejected by people of all backgrounds, all age demographics. I mean, the only people who aren't are people within the tech industry who are set to make a lot of money off of it. And, you know, I think it's always very telling how people like Andreessen and other AI promoters talk about it, because they're basically saying like they don't value what their own workers, their own employees do, because they think they can just replace them with a bot. Mm-hmm. But we all know that's not true, because these bots can only act based on what they're trained off of. And human beings in their everyday lives experience very unique circumstances that require thinking. And there's not a buy the book or, you know, just read the directions and do what they tell you sort of response. And the bots can't handle that stuff. So is your industry, is your business putting out anything that great if it could be run by just a bunch of robots? Like, sure, there are things that can be automated. We've been automating forever. We would love to automate factory work, because I think people would do, you know, people can do more than just, you know, sort of on the assembly line type stuff. And we've automated a lot of that stuff and only put people where it's absolutely necessary in a factory.
Right. Well, I mean, that's the point, is like technology is created by human beings, but it's owned by the most privileged 0.001%, these billionaire capitalists, to disempower the rest of us. Technology should be there, and technological improvement, to make people's lives easier, not to like poison all of our water and replace us in the workplace. I mean,
right, but what's really interesting is how, in his example, what was the bots improving, right? The bots, he made no mention of like productivity or the actual like work that their employees do. No, to him, bots were better because they weren't humans. They didn't have feelings or emotions. They didn't, they couldn't complain if they're being harassed sexually or otherwise. You know, that should tell everybody exactly what these people, these tech people are trying to do and what they want, on top of obviously wanting to make tons of money. They have ulterior motives, because that's just who they are. They're very anti-human people.
Right. And the references to Flock, we don't necessarily need to play it because I think that clip got the gist through. But yeah, he does a whole pitch for Flock, the surveillance software there. I think we had Jessica Burbank on.
She's still doing a ton of work on
it. Oh, nice. So yeah. People should check out her work. But she was covering, I think, in particular, like Scarsdale and how these police, these local police precincts are using Flock technology and not necessarily, you know, conferring with the population that's being surveilled. It's being promulgated fairly quickly. I mean, that's how tech operates. They ask for permission later and they integrate things into policing or surveillance or, you know, build a data center in your backyard that poisons your entire community. And then they ask for permission later. Reese from Tacoma, I personally have spent many hours programmatically automating away parts of my software engineering job, but I use it to take away the miserable BS I hate doing so that I can have fun working on tough problems. But I never let on to the employer how much I do, because now I go get to lower my average workload without it being made to fill it back up with 10 times responsibilities, to your point, Emma, about autonomy and control. G-Tier Smoke Alarm says, the CEOs just want to sit alone in their office in a giant empty building talking to a bunch of AIs while they passively just collect money and get glazed during CNBC hits. That's what I'm saying. The oligarchs of the Gilded Age, at the very least, were building infrastructure and also, in the end, got into, like, culture and the arts. These people are building their bunkers and isolating themselves from the rest of the world.
Yeah, I think a lot of them are also really insecure, like Elon Musk, about their lack of expertise and the things that they actually need to make their business run. And yeah. So if you can automate it, then you don't need rocket scientists or like programmers or any of the things that like actually make the business run. You can be like the genius CEO who's essentially just doing every part of the workflow yourself. And so, I mean, I think we now have an era where they actually believe that of themselves and they're trying to make it happen.
Right. Okay, so we have a late addition to sound that I want to play right before we say goodbye here, because in my wildest dreams, I don't know. This is really an admission from Trump that just is designed to tickle me in my funny bone here. I cannot believe he said this out loud, but it's the silver lining of him speedrunning the end of, American prominence in the world is that he's degrading and he gets more honest. So Don Jr., his son, is getting married this weekend. He was asked by a reporter if he will attend the wedding. Here we go.
Mr. President, are you having your son's wedding this weekend, by the way?
He'd like me to go, but it's going to be just a small little private affair, and I'm going to try and make it. I'm in the midst. I said, this is not good timing for me. I have a thing called Iran and other things. That's one I can't win on. If I do attend, I get killed. If I don't attend, I get killed. By the fake news, of course, I'm talking about. No, but he's got a very person who I've known for a long time. And hopefully they're going to have a great marriage.
Does he remember her name?
I just gotta say,
for a second I thought he was saying he knew his son for a long time.
I've known him almost his entire life. I mean, obviously I wasn't at the birth, but
I don't really do the baby stuff.
Gotta say, man, that is a very prominent outie that is just right behind him.
I was ignoring that.
I mean, it's a little distracting.
Good Lord. I didn't even wow,
look at that outie.
Yeah, they should have put him behind that chair.
It's like the umbilical cord still attached. So anyway, he really hates his son so much.
Trump would say, look at that outie. Is the umbilical cord still attached?
I call it an outie.
Yeah. Just came up with that myself. To be honest, I mean, if Trump still had it, he would have turned around. I can't believe he's openly waffling about attending.
He's like, I gave him a $6 billion no-bid contract from the Pentagon. Isn't that enough?
Yeah, right. That was a wedding gift? I gave a gift in a card. Yeah.
Dad, I'm still waiting on your RSVP. The deadline was 3 weeks ago. I got a war on Iran.
He's going to self-medicate extra hard.
Oh, my God.
I got to say, I actually don't think anyone would give him shit for attending his son's
wedding. Of course!
For a short period of time.
That's his own excuse.
What are you talking about, Bender? No one cares.
Of course, right. But just being clear here. In case any right-wingers are watching and are like, oh, you lefties. No, I'm saying openly that if he went, like maybe if he went away for like a week-long a wedding trip in Mexico or something, we'd have an issue with that. But we're talking a one day, a few hours. No one would have a problem with him attending his son's wedding.
He goes golfing every day.
Yes.
we complain about that. I wouldn't complain about the son's wedding.
No, but I'm saying the Swiss cheese out of his argument. He doesn't give a shit if he gets killed for where he goes.
He has free time. He has free time. Despite it all.
I mean, he's been divorced so many times. He probably just feels like it's not that big of a deal. Like, I mean, it's like, oh, you know, I don't go to this one. I'll go to the next one. Maybe the one after that.
Right. I was seeing that apparently the tally, according to the Bulwark, is that Trump has gone golfing 14 times since the Iran war started, which is a level of restraint for him, if that is the actual figure. But I would be hesitant to attribute it to personal restraint and more to the failing health that he's experiencing. But probably healthy enough to sit in a chair and eat a lobster tail.
I don't have that golf body anymore.
Yeah, I'm too self-conscious to attend the wedding. Oh. I'm sorry to say, but I am tickled and thinking
Connor's
about
wedding in succession.
Exactly.
I hope it ends exactly like that.
Me too. Me too. Oh, please.
He's marrying Kimberly Gargoyle, right? Isn't he?
No, Gargoyle and him broke up. Yeah, he's got a little, you know, she's blonde. I don't really know anything about her. I know maybe more
he's
about her than Trump. Yeah.
She's blonde.
Known them for a long time. I don't think he knows her name.
He clearly forgot her name mid-sentence.
Oh, God, I mean, honestly, sometimes the best tea times are in the afternoon when it's a little cooler if you can't get a morning tea time. And that's usually when the reception kicks off.
Imagine the president's, I can't get a tea time.
where's the wedding going to be? Like, they couldn't have done it at the White House? I mean,
there's no ballroom construction.
It's too drab.
There's no ballroom. UFC arena for a one day of a UFC event. They couldn't throw like together a little something for the wedding.
That's about Trump. It's about him. This is not about him.
Trump Jr., 48, announced in December during a White House holiday party that he's engaged to socialite Bettina Anderson, 37. The pair began appearing in public together a year earlier. Anderson had a bridal shower in Mar-a-Lago, the president's Palm Beach estate, last month. They're going to be married in a private island in the Bahamas over the weekend. It would be Trump Jr.'s second marriage.
There was a private island that opened up a few years ago.
Yeah. Prime real estate.
You know what? So I think he's making the good choice not going.
is Kai gonna be there?
He's on an island right now.
He's like, Donnie, why are you doing this to me? I can't go back to a private island in the Caribbean,
right? Especially when that granddaughter that I parade around, who's so hot, is gonna be there. That's the one that they're trying to make into a celebrity is Don Jr.'s kid, Kai, the one that they're so creepy about. Anyway, man. That was a beautiful, beautiful clip.
I'm going to a private island in the Bahamas. I'm taking my young minor granddaughter with me. We're going on a private plane. My best friend, who is also my female assistant who procures things for me, is joining us on the plane.
Right. Or, you know, Trump gives a speech at the wedding and gives recognition for the people that are with us and who are no longer with us, right, including my best friend, Jeffrey Epstein, who I keep thinking about him when I'm down there. I see him everywhere when I close my eyes.
I'm
miss him too. I miss him so much. I can't go back there.
It's too triggering. Too triggered. I'm going to read some IMs here. Paris Smart. I feel like my brain is sometimes our spacey as Trump, but I also carry an emotional support weed vape everywhere I go. Jay Tingle. It was scheduled for the White House, but was deemed inappropriate because of the war. Really?
Wait, the wedding?
I'm not sure if that's a joke or not. But also, like, how quickly Trump in a private plane could get down to the Bahamas. I mean, it's easy. Yeah, it's easy.
He has experience. He's done it.
I mean, especially Jeffrey if he was in Mar-a-Lago.
No one knows about it but me.
Wait, hold on. Flight from Miami to Bahamas.
Probably 45 minutes.
I 55 minutes. Yeah. 35 minutes nonstop in this one.
He's going an green.
Hour max.
He's going green now. Like, yeah, he's trying to reduce his carbon footprint. He's right. Flying too much this year.
He's only wearing thrifted clothes now, and he would only go to the wedding if he could use the ship that Greta used to get to the U.S.
Flights are too expensive. I can't swing it, Donnie.
Right.
Straight up Hormuz, ran out of jet fuel.
Hack all the things. Let's be honest, they'd have an issue that the wedding was in Mexico, not that it was a week long. Fair enough. Pearl necklace says, at least my dad loved me. Gage muted the belly button in the background is distracting. Yeah. Sick Love Economy, I can't stop staring at that dude's zany belly button. I would love to know who the owner of that is.
Thank you for pointing it out, Emma. I appreciate that.
You're welcome. It's called journalism.
You know what I would have done if I missed that?
Your life would be much less rich than it is today. Mini psychologist. I'd imagine every billionaire would qualify as a psychopath. Not joking. Yeah. G tier smoke alarm. The CEOs just want. I already read that. All right. Five more. Dan from Columbus. Nearly $2 billion estimated net worth, and somehow Mark Andreessen can't afford nasal strips. Either move away from the mic when you inhale or spend the $12 for a 30 pack at Kroger. Damn it.
This is the kind of shit Mark wouldn't have to hear if he had bots.
Exactly, right. No complaining about my breathing. To more from the five, Emma, are you really chat GPTing on a podcast in real time? Are you the left-wing Jillian Michaels? That was a Google search. I would never chat GPT Iran regime change.
Chat GPTing, did we kill thousands of Iranian civilians?
And yet still having the arrogance to come to Sam with a definitive kind of posture about the situation.
Right. We're going to have to get into that tomorrow.
Yes, I will not be here. I am going to be away.
Yeah, I mean, you've already done what, like 2 days this week, right?
Are you filling a void that Sam has left? Like, what's going on here?
Well, I made a joke with you not here about it, and I feel rude talking behind people's backs.
That's so very principled of you. Yeah. Brian's corpse writes in, love that IM name. Do you all think Trump is pushing for a pardon for Netanyahu as a part of negotiations with Israel to get them to cool it for the Iran deal to be easier? It's an interesting theory.
Who's
given the fact
who in that
the Israeli courts.
Oh,
it's an interesting theory. I mean, the fact that he brought up his legal troubles, you know, seems like maybe that's at the top of mind, but I don't know. I think you might be attributing too much fortitude and like direction from Trump. Mm-hmm. Commie Tommy, that was an umbilical stump. And the final I am of the day. Mm-mm. Martig, he knows it's a business arrangement, just setting Junior up to run for POTUS, which Trump can't really face because it would mean he's done. Fair enough. Tames Darwin says, pretty sure both Nixon and LBJ married off their daughters during Vietnam. Yes. Yeah. It's no problem. It's not a problem at all. All right, guys. Appreciate you all. Yes, I will be out tomorrow. My best friend from high school, it's her bachelorette party. I set her up with one of my good friends from college. So it's pretty much all about me anyway. But I'm very excited. So, yes.
It's not smart for you to go, Emma. People are going to talk. People are going to stay. The right and the left are going to attack you for going.
I worry.
I don't know if you've heard of this little thing called Iran.
Yeah, right. I should be focused on that. All right, guys. Appreciate you all. We will be back. The show will be back tomorrow. Thanks, Binder. Thanks, Brandon. Thanks, Matt Leck. Hope he's feeling better. And Brian. See you then.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught. See the truth in the light bar. Finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot light's shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made. For the option where you don't get paid. For the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive.